Welcome to episode 113 of GBW Podcast. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
Hello.
You're very muted today.
I'm trying to change it up a little bit, you know, so people don't get bored.
By talking monotone.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Don't get bored. Get ready. It's been 3 weeks. We're going to talk about the shitload of stuff we watched. Yeah. And it's going to be like 2.5 hours at least.
No, don't say that, man, because that means it'll only be like an hour.
Yeah, and that would really throw everyone for a fucking loop.
It's going to happen one of these days, man. We were planning our summer schedule earlier, and I'm foreseeing there may be a shorter episode.
I'm foreseeing a shorter episode sometime in July.
I do think that might happen.
I think so.
We've both got travel plans. I'm going to Detroit and New York City. Chris is going camping on a camping vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're
going to Banff.
Banff. I've always wanted to go to Banff, actually.
It's nice.
Yeah. Have you been there?
Oh,
before?
Yeah. We went a couple of years ago. I might go to Calgary.
Calgary?
Calgary. Oh. Apparently, we're out there Stampede weekend.
Oh, nice.
But I'm not going.
I heard the pancakes are really good.
I'm not going.
Why?
I can't stand fucking crowds like that, dude. Anyway, that's not movie
talk.
Isn't
it something you should go to once, though?
I don't know. I don't know. I just picture like a bunch of like rowdy cowboys drinking beers and raping people.
You know, oh my god! I don't know.
I'm playing stereotypes right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not movie talk, and you know we're spending too much time on this if we're gonna get under that capper. So this episode is just what we've watched in the past 3 weeks.
Yes.
No topic, just pure goodness.
Yeah.
Not that our topics aren't pure goodness, but this is the main part of our show anyway.
It is.
So it's not going to be a surprise to everybody that we have almost 20 movies to talk about.
We have more than 20. Oh, no, we have 20. No, we
19.
Have 19.
19. Is this Paul Hardcastle in the house? In Vietnam, the young soldier. Anyway.
That was a cool song.
Kick it.
Oh, am I starting?
Yeah, kick it.
Okay. I got a weird mix this time. Anyway. Okay.
Remember, don't lead with the shit. Okay. Save that for the middle of the show.
Well, seeing as I'm going to New York City, I decided that I should start watching some films that feature New York City.
So that your nerdiness can track down the locations.
That's true. I've already mapped out Death Wish, Warriors.
French Connection,
yep. So I'm going to be mapping out all the locations and nerding it up.
Oh, yeah.
So I haven't seen this one in a while. And, you know, often when I'm thinking about New York movies, you know, obviously New York of the 1970s and 1980s is kind of, you know, what movie fans, especially like cult cinema fans yep. like us think of, right? And I always, you know, the go-tos are always like in my brain, like Bill Lustig, Larry Cohen, those yeah. guys.
Hannon Lauder,
yeah. But I always, that's what I'm always thinking of when I think of New York movies. So I grabbed this one, and I've seen it before, obviously, and I just, you know, I don't know why I never think of this one top of mind, because I sure as shit should. And that's a little movie called Taxi Driver.
Nice.
And, you know, directed by Martin Scorsese, of course, in 1976. And I've seen Taxi Driver a few times in my life. But I really, it is really one of the definitive New York films. And I yep. didn't really, I never really put that together. I don't know why, like, I just never think of that right away. But I should, because it's definitely one of the sleaziest New York movies there is, and definitely Scorsese in this time period definitely had the same thing going on that Bill Lustig had going on in Maniac and Walter Hill had going on in The Warriors, like that gritty, dark, kind of freaky New York City, and I loved it all over again.
Robert, kind of the New York City that kind of frightened us.
Yeah.
But also made us want to go there.
Totally. So, of course, Robert De Niro stars as Travis Bickle. And, you know, De Niro is another guy. Like, and I think it just recently, just with some of the, you know, a lot of actors, you know, as they get older, they just stop being as cool as they once were.
Him and Pacino.
But, you know, Pacino, like, De Niro had a pretty good run for a pretty long time. And
well, so did Pacino in the 70s.
He did. Yeah. And I might talk about another movie with Pacino later, maybe. But De Niro, man, holy shit, this guy was just on fire and so great in this movie. And I kind of forget sometimes about, and I think just because Taxi Driver is just so much a part of like the cinema vernacular that like I almost don't even think about it anymore. Like there's a lot of big movies like that, like the Godfather movies or other ones where I almost don't even think of how great they are, but they have their reputation for a reason. And, man, if anyone's listening to this and hasn't seen Taxi Driver yet, yeah, it's really, you really should, because this is, it's something else. And it's just so, for a pretty mainstream movie at the time, I mean, this was, you know, had a big cast, and it was a big movie back then. It had, I think he was up for Oscars, but I can't imagine something like this being made today. And
well, no, there's no way.
There's no way. And,
no
and,
way.
And just even reading about like the making of it and how like Scorsese like, you know, delivered its first cut and it was like X-rated. And then he like, you know, there's like legends about him like sitting there with a gun in the editing room, like ready to kill the executive if they didn't let the movie pass as an R. Like, and I believe it. Like, I think that's the way it was in kind of the Wild West of the 70s. And I just think that stuff is so fascinating. And you just wouldn't have a movie with a guy like a war veteran kind of fucking up as much as this guy does. Yeah. But at the same time, like, it's all driven by loneliness and just mental illness and
not being cared for by your government when you're a war veteran.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, it doesn't totally like
it doesn't go there
it
as
doesn't
much,
get
but,
into that but yeah, you know, it's kind of
it's the underlying
we all knew that. Yeah. Right. And but at the same time, like, the guy's, I think, you know, has good intentions for the most part, and he just can't operate in society. And it's a really, really great character study, but it's just also, it clips along so well. And you know, again, 70s movies, you don't know what's going to happen like as you're watching this. So, man, I would love to have watched Taxi Driver again for the first time. I mean, I kind of know, I know what's going to happen, and I know how it ends up. I actually had forgotten how it ended. But, you know, it's just such a different time. And it was just watching Travis Bickle walking around the streets and driving around the streets and seeing Times Square back in the day with all the porn theaters. And it's just, yeah, it's, I really kind of forget about this one sometimes and just forget about how fucking awesome Scorsese was. And all those big directors at the time, but Scorsese in particular, I mean, he was gritty as fuck, as was Paul Schrader, who wrote this. And, it's, you know, I should feel like I should go back to a little bit more often. I probably watch it every 10 years or so. And, but I watched it on Blu-ray. I got that media book edition that was put out a few years ago.
That's the one I have too.
Yeah. And it's, man, it was really, really good. And, you know, just Harvey Keitel, like, so young as the asshole pimp, and Sybil Shepherd playing Betsy, who's this beautiful kind of, like, iconic woman that Travis Bickle wants it, and he actually gets a shot with, but then, you know, can't operate properly, and just takes her on, like, one of the most cringe-inducing dates you'll ever see. And
well, and the great thing about Sybil Shepherd in this movie is that I feel like everybody just pictures her as like moonlighting.
Yeah.
And, you know, like comedy and stuff. And, you know, I don't think she gets enough credit for her 70s work, really. Like this and Last Picture Show, is it?
Yeah,
that she's
Last
in?
Picture
yeah.
Show,
and she's
yeah.
really good in that, too. And she's good in Taxi Driver. So, you know, it's a guy like Scorsese is kind of like, he was kind of doing in the 70s. What Tarantino's doing nowadays,
yeah.
where he's taking actors who you wouldn't expect to do these roles,
yeah,
and then having them deliver this performance where you're like, okay, now I can see the talent that's underlying that I might not have seen. Like, for us, we didn't see Taxi Driver when it first came out, right? I had already been familiar with her from Moonlighting and stuff. So to see that kind of performance, you're like, oh, I guess she isn't just this comedian, pratfalling, lusting over Bruce Willis kind of girl that I thought she was.
Yeah.
So that's great.
And and obviously as a young woman, she was taking some more risky roles as well. Yeah. Now, she didn't have a ton to do in the movie.
Well, but it's just a different perspective on her as an actor, I think.
It is. And the apple pie scene is just totally classic with the two of them. And Jodie Foster, of course, in this. I mean, I'm not a huge Jodie Foster fan anymore, but holy fuck, like, you just realize, like, this girl was, you know, young. I mean, she was playing 12 years old in the movie, and she couldn't have been that much older in real life. And
because this was the same year that she did That Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane,
right,
with Martin Sheen.
Yeah,
where Martin Sheen was like a creeper.
Yeah,
and she was like 12 too. And I've never seen it, but I've heard things, and I do have the Kino Blu-ray of that at home.
Oh, do you?
But yeah, she was super young. Like, and then she followed Taxi Driver and that up with Freaky Friday.
Yeah.
And I love Freaky Friday, don't get me wrong, but it just seems weird that someone that young would be able to take a role like that.
Well, and just also the fact that someone that young is playing a prostitute who's probably got a drug problem, that someone that young, like, shadowed a real prostitute to try and learn, like, come on, man, like, that, I just wouldn't
get away with that these days.
I can't picture that happening now. I can't picture an actor even being that committed. I shouldn't say that. I'm sure there's some, but it certainly wouldn't fly in a mainstream movie these days. Joe Spinell shows up, and he was in this. He was in Godfather Part 2 and I think Part 1. Like, Joe Spinell, like, who a lot of people, horror fans, only know from, like, Maniac. I mean, he was in some pretty awesome movies in the 70s, like, as a character actor, and I think we often forget about that, too. And he's, you know, he usually plays kind of a similar type of dark role. Like, he's usually some sort of sleaziness going on, but he was pretty solid, and it wasn't in this a ton, but still pretty great. Scorsese's has a cameo in this movie that's just super memorable and super freaky, where he's basically playing a husband of someone who's cheating on him, and is just talking to Travis about how he's gonna take out his wife, and it's super creepy. Kind of pretty real feeling scene, and Scorsese had to jump in at the last minute to play that role, and it definitely stands out, and it's one of those things that I think of when I think of Taxi Driver. Albert Brooks, someone who's mainly known for comedies, no, smart comedies, but still comedies, is pretty brilliant. And this is Sybil Shepherd's friend, who's like kind of watching over her in a really kind of, like, obviously he wants to be with Sybil Shepherd and is jealous of Travis and stuff. And he's pretty entertaining in this as well. But just overall, it's just a super, super good movie. I think it's one that I don't know if a lot of people have seen anymore. Like, we've seen it, but
multiple times.
But I don't know if a lot of younger people would have seen it. So I would encourage you to, if you have not. So that's Taxi Driver, one of the definitive New York City movies.
I was just going to add that, about Albert Brooks. I forgot he was in this.
Hmm.
And you're right, he is mostly known for comedy, but I remember when he popped up in Drive.
Oh, I haven't seen Drive yet.
I was like, oh, Albert Brooks, and he's playing a heavy. This is pretty rad.
Yeah.
So, Taxi Driver is one of those kind of definitive 70s experiences.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to see kind of what was going on in that decade and how mainstream cinema was entirely different even from how it was in the 80s, for sure.
And I didn't make notes on this, but I did also watch Godfather Part 2 in the last couple of weeks as well, and it was a first time watch for me. I always watched Godfather and never made it through Godfather 2.
And 2 is supposed to be the better movie.
Yeah, I disagree.
I haven't seen any of them, so I can't say.
But that is people do say that. I don't agree with that, but what I did realize watching 2 is, because Pacino and De Niro are both in it.
Yeah.
I just realized just how much better De Niro was, like, in my opinion.
Well, is that the Pacino, is that the movie you're going to talk about with Pacino as Godfather?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, like, what I was talking about for his run in the 70s was Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, and things like that. Like, he was great in those.
No, he had, and he was great in the Godfather movies, but I just, it was interesting seeing them both in the same movie. Now, they're not on screen together ever in that movie because they're playing two completely different time periods. But when De Niro is on screen, you are just totally captivated. Whereas Pacino, I just felt, no, I mean, he wasn't a very nice guy, so I wasn't really that sympathetic towards him. But it was just like night and day when I was like so looking forward to the De Niro parts. And then when the Pacino parts were on, I was kind of like, ugh. You know, I mean, still a great movie, obviously. But maybe it's just because I've seen Godfather 1 so many times, and because James Caan's in it, and Brando, of course. And I just find, like, the set pieces in the first one a lot more engaging. And just the fact that you're kind of with the characters a little more, I felt like, in the first movie than you are in Godfather Part 2. But yes, I mean, a lot of people definitely put it up there as the better.
Yeah, I can't speak on that.
But De Niro, holy shit. Like, just the guy was just a powerhouse.
Yeah, it's just, it's sad now that I feel like guys like De Niro and Pacino, who were considered to be powerhouses in like the 70s and the 80s and stuff, are now having to resort to being in movies like, you know, The Intern and Jack and Jill and all these dumbass comedies.
It is kind of odd. And
I mean, I guess they have to do it if they want to work. So, but it's just so disappointing at the same time.
Now, I talked about Heat a while ago, which was awesome. And, you know, but that was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And now it'll be interesting to see what happens with The Irishman, with them both returning with Scorsese. So,
well, yeah, and I'm super excited to see Pacino in the new Tarantino movie, too. So,
yeah. Oh, I didn't know he was in it.
Yeah. So, okay. I think that'll be like kind of a help of a resurgence of him too. Cause he did that. What was the movie he did? Was it that was Michael Douglas that was in the Liberace movie. Yeah. He was in some HBO thing not that long ago that was well received and had him kind of going back to being an actual actor.
Okay.
But, I would love both of them to actually recapture some of that 70s glory.
Yeah.
And not have to be in a fucking movie with Adam Sandler or someone like that who has no discernible talent in my eyes. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. Well, since I've got mostly mediocrity, I don't know how I'm going to follow up Taxi Driver, which is like one of the 10 70s movies I'd say you should see.
Yeah.
I guess I'll follow it up with a movie that's not good, but that I was entertained thoroughly through, and a movie that you, my friend, will want to watch.
God.
It's a movie from 2015 called The Boy Next Door, produced by Blumhouse, starring Jennifer Lopez.
No, I wouldn't want to watch this.
You want to know why you want to watch this, dude? So Jennifer Lopez plays an English teacher.
That's a Blumhouse movie?
It's a Blumhouse movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Jennifer Lopez plays an English teacher. A new family moves in next door that have a teenage son played by Ryan Guzman. So instantly he's got the muscles. He's like kind of looking like Mark Wahlberg did in Fear in a way. And, you know, he befriends Jennifer Lopez's son because right now her and her husband played by John Corbett are going through a messy breakup.
Oh, John Corbett.
John Corbett. So, you know, things go along, they're friends, he starts coming over, this guy from next door, this Noah kid, I think his name's Noah in the movie, and you know, one day dad and son are away and they fuck. Jennifer Lopez and the boy next door fuck.
Really?
He's a high school student.
Oh my
who's
god.
In her class.
What?
And she fucks him. From there, after this fairly steamy sex scene, it becomes a crazy guy movie because she tries to tell him, no, we can't do this anymore. And he's like, nope, we're doing it. Too bad for you. I'm going to do a bunch of psychotic shit to prove to you that I want to have sex with you again. I'm going to cut brake lines. I'm going to have this sordid history. I'm going to do things where I manipulate things at school so that it goes my way. Now are you interested?
Oh, no. Yes. I don't want to watch a J-Lo movie.
I didn't either. But because it was a crazy guy movie, that's why I watched it. So there's some hilarious shit in this movie, dude. There's a scene where after they've had sex, she's trying to be like, oh, I've done a terrible thing. I don't know what we need to end this. But he's still friends with my son, so he's still coming over to the house whenever he wants. And he comes over to the house while the husband is there. And just after they've gone away on this fish trip, he's like, oh, how was your guys' weekend? He's like, yeah, I heard it rained up here. He's like, oh, it was so moist this weekend.
Oh, my God.
And then Jennifer Lopez, he's like, oh, my mom baked some cookies. Do you want some cookies? He's like, I love your mom's cookies. Just these fucking innuendos that made me howl. I was just like, okay, this is a fucking terribly written movie. And it doesn't make sense most of the time. Like, there's absolutely no logic to anything that happens in this movie. But I'm just like, I'm just along for this big, dumb fucking ride. And it's totally delivering on that aspect. It's a bad movie. But damned if it wasn't like 90 minutes of like, holy shit, this is entertaining because it's so stupid.
Wow.
You know, and then there's like, you know, there's a scene in it where he's like, to try and impress her, he's like, oh, I got you a present. I bought you this first edition of the Iliad by Homer because you're a classic English teacher. And I'm just like, what the fuck are you talking about? That book's thousands of years old. How do you get a first edition? And it looks like one of those books you buy at like the bookstore that's like a classic that's been rebound in those leather covers yeah, with like yeah. the glittery writing on yeah. it. And it looks like one of those. And I'm like, come the fuck on. Are you actually trying to pass this off in this movie? Like, give me a fucking break right now.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, and then... You know, there's a pretty kick-ass finale that, you know, goes places. There's a lot of fire. There's a lot of EpiPens, and you'll see when you watch it. And there's just all this stuff going on, and I'm like, this is so stupid. But I'm entertained, even though it's stupid.
You had me at EpiPens.
And honestly, dude, there's two scenes in this movie involving EpiPens that are pretty fucking great.
Well, of course, because the one has to foreshadow the other, right?
Well, the one that Here's the thing. This is a mild spoiler, but I have to do it. Just to show you how badly written this movie is, Jennifer Lopez's son has, you know, he needs EpiPens because he's got, you know, a condition. Well, when he's in high school gym class just punching a speed bag and he goes into full-on anaphylactic shock, and the other guy has to run and get his EpiPen while everyone else just stands around and watches. The only thing that was running through my mind wasn't, oh my God, I hope he's okay. It was, why the fuck is he having a friggin' issue right now where he needs an EpiPen? He was just punching a speed bag. How would that possibly set him off?
Maybe the last person who punched it, like, ate peanut butter.
I don't know, but this is how badly written this movie is.
That is weird.
And I'm just like, no.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, you've got the main character, like, basically telling the vice principal she's a cunt and getting expelled, but no, at no time are any cops called for any of his bad behavior.
Wow.
I'm just like, this movie's so fucking badly written.
I can't believe this is Blumhouse.
It's Blumhouse. But I'll tell you another reason why I watched this, Josh. This movie is directed by Rob Cohen. The last movie we watched that Rob Cohen directed was a movie called Hurricane Heist.
I think I almost... Did I watch a Rob Cohen movie? I might have. Oh my God.
He's also a guy who directed Fast and the Furious, the original, and Triple X.
Yeah.
So he's another guy where I'm like, I know Hurricane Heist was ridiculous, but what are you doing directing a crazy guy movie a couple years before that?
Yeah.
Like, there's stuff in this movie, dude, that rivals the face coming out of the fucking hurricane cloud in Hurricane Heist. Okay? Sold, right?
That was awesome.
Sold. Yeah, that was pretty fucking awesome. Let's reminisce about Hurricane Heist for a minute. Death head skull in the hurricane cloud. Oh, Silo rolling over dad. I love you, Hurricane Heist, even though you're bad.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the same situation here. It's a bad movie, but it's highly watchable.
Nice.
And Jennifer Lopez is terrible in this.
Oh, she's always terrible.
She's always terrible. Yeah. The only movie I can think of that I actually thought she was okay was Out of Sight, the Steven Soderbergh movie with George Clooney.
Okay, I'll give you that.
But apart from that, She's terrible. I don't understand. I haven't
seen Selena. Isn't that the one she got
She's not good in that.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
But I'm just like...
Not that I ever will.
When Ryan Guzman, who's a guy I've never heard of, he's in like some of the Step Up movies, apparently.
Oh.
He's the psycho guy. He was pretty good. John Corbett was pretty good. Even freaking, I can't remember her name. Oh, there's the girl who's her best friend, who's also the vice principal, who I can't stand in most things she's in. I don't know her name right now. It's really embarrassing. I'm going to have to look it up. Bear with me. I'm going to look it up on air because that's how I roll right now. We need to pad this out anyway, right?
No, we don't. We're only on the second movie.
Hang on.
People hate
Kristen
this.
Kristen Chenoweth.
People, oh, fuck.
I cannot fucking stand her.
Oh, my God. Okay, you might have lost me now.
She's better than Jennifer Lopez in this.
Oh, I don't know if I can do a movie.
Dude, she's not in it that much. You'll be fine. So, like I said, it's terrible, but it's highly entertaining.
The dog's reacting.
The dog's even having a bad time. There's a dog outside crying. It's like, Jennifer Lopez, no! Anyway, I can't recommend it as a good movie, but I can recommend it for people who just like those ridiculous, crazy guy-girl movies that shouldn't exist but keep getting made. So,
I didn't know it was a crazy guy movie.
Yeah, so that's The Boy Next Door. From Blumhouse.
Okay. All right. Well, I kept my New York thing going on here, and I decided to go into the second movie of a franchise.
Oh.
And I went for John Wick Chapter 2.
Okay.
Now, dude, I don't get...
I haven't seen any of them.
I really don't get it. Huh. Why you're not watching these movies.
I'm going to.
Because... Okay, so I like the first John Wick fine.
I've heard the second one's better.
It didn't blow me away like I thought it was going to, but it was good. It was a good movie. But this one, holy shit, man. This movie is just so over the top. Like, okay, so 2017.
Don't spoil anything, please.
Again, directed by Chad Stahelski and starring Keanu Reeves as John Wick.
Whoa.
The guy who... whose dog died in the first movie and he went out for revenge. And this one, it's kind of more of the same. It's just this time around, he is put into a situation where he pretty much has like all of the assassins in New York City trying to kill him.
I thought you were going to say, this movie's turned up to 11.
No. But I can't... Yeah, I mean, if I'm not going to spoil anything, I can't really say much more. But everything is amped up in this movie. Now, part of it takes place in Italy. Part of it takes place in New York. But in both sections, like, the action sequences in this are just so well done. And, man, there is so many headshots in this movie, like, with a gun. Like, it's just crazy. Speaking of Taxi Driver, I can't believe this shit's out there because it is so violent. Like, and it's not like I wasn't like, oh, my God, it's so violent. I don't know if I can watch it. Like, it wasn't, like, gory violent like you know, fucking Serbian film or something.
Right.
But it was just so, like, just... Literally, he's just shooting everyone in the head. It was just like, oh, my God. But I really, really, really liked it. And I just thought it was just such a improvement from the first movie. Great cast again. Ricardo Scarmario. I'm sorry, I can't read my own freaking writing. Scarmacchio plays Santino, who's like the villain. Ian McShane and Lance Reddick return from the first movie.
Ian McShane's in both? I love Ian McShane.
Yeah, and he's pretty good, as is Lance Reddick. Lance Reddick was on The Wire. Ruby Rose is a kind of a female assassin. She was really great in this. She's starting to make a bit of a name for herself in action movies. She was in not that these are great movies, but she was in XXX, the Return of Xander Cage. She was in the last Resident Evil movie, and she was in The Meg. So she's picking some cool roles, and I kind of like that she's choosing roles like this, right? Like, it's kind of good to have someone like this coming up. Common was in this, playing an assassin, pretty good. Peter Stormare, who's always pretty good, shows up. fucking Franco Nero shows up. And Larry Fishburne, or Lawrence, sorry, oh my God, Lawrence Fishburne shows up, and really great seeing him and Keanu on screen together again since The Matrix. So, yeah, definitely just such a huge difference over the first one. And not that the first one was bad, but holy, like, this just took it to another level. So
I feel like with part three out now, I should probably just,
yeah, you know, man, like, don't,
I've got the first two on Blu-ray, so
yeah, you should get on that, because I also watched part three.
Okay.
Because and the reason I watched part two is because I'm like, you know what, these movies are really good, and I need to see part three in the theater. So I got to catch up, and I'd suggest you do the same. So John Wick Part Chapter 3, Parabellum, 2019, again directed by Chad Stahelski. And, you know, John Wick's back, so, you know, sorry, spoiler alert, but you already know that he's alive. And this time around, he's, it's not centered in New York, and again, he's got a bounty on his head, and everyone is out to get him. And, this one, I like this one because it had, it opened up the world a little bit. Ian McShane and Lance Reddick are back, as is Lawrence Fishburne. Halle Berry shows up, and I would not have known it was her if I didn't know it was her going in. But she was rad, and there is a scene with her and Keanu and some dogs, and it is just so fucking frenetic and crazy, and just shit going on all over the place, and the cameras flying around, but not in a bad way. Like, it was just so, like, I just felt like I was in the middle of this, like, not so action scene, like, and I really felt like I was there, probably because I was in the theater, and I was just so fucking happy I went and saw this in the theater. Mark Duskoskos, sorry,
nice,
is fucking rad, and like, I've liked him for years.
Yeah, I like him too.
Since I was a teenager, probably.
Yeah, I like him too.
And he's, you know, I mean, you know, people that listen to this show probably know him from things like Double Dragon, or maybe like
Drive is a movie he made in the 97 that's really good.
Yeah, he was in tons. And
yeah, he was like a more of those, like,
Only the Strong is, yeah, one I talked about on the show. There was that one, Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Yeah, he, like, was in the movie DNA that I've talked about in the past, which isn't a great movie, but he was fine in
he's
it.
He's always good, right? Yeah. Like, he's one of those guys that it was just always a solid, like, 90s action star. And he's been working pretty steadily. He was on, like, he's been doing some TV lately. And then he was, like, on Iron Chef, which I thought was the weirdest thing.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I think that's where a lot of people know him,
yeah,
from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they don't know about this action star past of his. But he's back in this as a full action star.
People just know him from biting a pepper and raising an eyebrow.
Totally. Mm. But, and yeah, because I know I was talking to someone at work about this, and they're like, yeah, the guy from Iron Chef. And I'm like, that's Mark Duskoskos, man. Like, the guy's a martial arts legend. Like, he's awesome. Anyway, it's really cool to see him making kind of I'm calling it a comeback, but it's almost like a debut in a way. And he is so good in this, and his fight scenes are all great, and he is great. Like, he's one of those villains, kind of almost like a Billy Zane. Like, he's just so charismatic, and you're just loving every minute where he's on screen. And I'm so happy for him that he's been able to get this kind of exposure, because I think people are really gonna love him in this movie. So really, really great to see him. Asya Kate Dillon plays a character called the Adjudicator. Pretty threatening, pretty cool. Angelica Houston shows up. Jason Mantzoukas shows up. And Robin Lord Taylor from Gotham has a very, very small role. But yeah, man, just this is, again, just a really, really fun movie, and just got some really unique, puts John Wick into some unique situations. He uses, again, some very unique methods of killing people, and one involving a horse that I just laughed out loud, and there's, like, a book involved in something, and it's just really original, and I really, really love the way the action scenes are directed in all of these movies. I think I liked two a little better than this one, but and I think I sat maybe a little too close to the screen because there was just so much happening, but still really, really solid, and pretty excited for this franchise to continue. So I would recommend, if you can, to try and watch those two and see this one in the theater.
Yeah, I've seen the clip of him, of Keanu riding the horse down the middle of traffic. I'm like, that might be cool.
it's pretty cool, man. There's some motorbike stuff going on in this. Okay. It's pretty cool. And it's really good.
I might have to pull the first one out of my bookcase and put it on my coffee table.
Yeah, watch the first
two. Maybe I should
try
and watch the first one for next episode at least.
Yeah, but try and watch it so you can see this in the theater.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I'd almost go again, man. Like it's just so. These are good movies.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. So if you're into action, maybe if you didn't really like the first John Wick, I mean, most people did, but keep going because this franchise gets better.
All right. Well. God damn! I wish this wasn't all mediocrity for the most part. I'm just going to quickly talk about this one because it's not really that memorable as a movie, but I just wanted to bring it up because I watched it. For some reason, when I was away last week, I put a movie on Netflix late at night, and I was like, you know, I want something mindless that's like under 90 minutes long that, you know, has something about it that I might like. So I decided to watch 2018's Action Point. Now,
that's on my like to watch list.
Yeah, the reason I watched it is because I actually do like Johnny Knoxville.
Yeah, me too.
Like I legitimately think that he's pretty charismatic and doesn't seem to take himself seriously at all. And he just seems to be like a kind of a cool guy in general. Like, you know, I watched Grand Theft Parsons not that long ago with him, and that movie was pretty good. And he's the reason I put this one on. And also because it was based on like a real life theme park. So the story behind this is Johnny Knoxville saw a documentary about Action Park, which was a theme park that was in New Jersey. And it's infamous for being it was like a crazy theme park where the rides were unsafe and badly designed. So people kept getting injured. And, you know, a lot of times they would employ like underage people and they would let them like get drunk and operate the machines and run the games and like do drugs and all sorts of crazy shit were going on. Like if you look up Action Park, there's a lot of stories out there from people who went to it that are fucking crazy, like crazy.
Wow.
So, I was like, okay, you got me on the fact that you're basing it on that. And you got me on the fact that you got Johnny Knoxville in this, but where you lose me is just making it into a dumb comedy with a boring formula plot.
Mm.
So the plot is Johnny Knoxville decides to start. He has this theme park and it's kind of failing because there's competition coming in. And then at the same time, it's that typical plot of us versus them because there's a land developer who's trying to like buy the park out from under him.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of bullshit that you see in all these kind of movies. And then there's also a subplot where his younger teenage daughter comes to stay with him and he has to try and bond with her by making Action Point into like the successful and fight the man and I'm your dad and I'm not really a jerk and you love me and all that, you know, that kind of stuff. And then there's just your typical like Johnny Knoxville's like, hey, remember when I was on Jackass and stuff happened to me and it was funny? How about I make like a raunchy comedy where we can put in moments where it's like Jackass? So it's like, because it's a dangerous theme park, we'll have a scene where I'm riding one of those slide things. Like, you know, those kind of slidey carts that go down the concrete track?
Yeah.
Like on a hill. Let's have me going down on one of those and I'll fly off the edge of the track and land with this big thud, like real life stunt. Like Jackass.
Okay.
Let's do that.
That's what I thought this movie was. I thought it was just a bunch of that.
No, it's an actual narrative.
Oh, okay.
With Jackass scenes in it. So I feel like Johnny Knoxville was like, hey, let's go for it. I got nothing better to do right now, right? And I knew that's what the whole point was because he cast Chris Pontius from Jackass in one of the side roles.
Yeah.
And he's pretty bad in this, admittedly. He's not an actor, okay?
I haven't seen that guy since Wild Boys or...
Yeah, so he's cast in a side role, and it's just... The movie just seems to be trying way too hard. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's got a formula plot. It's got these dumb jackass-like stunts. It tries to be raunchy and doesn't really work. Like, it has a scene where he's like, oh, we're going to break into the rival theme park to steal stuff from them. And then when I'm in the locker room, I'm going to, like, take a piss on their uniforms just to show them how much I hate them. You know, that kind of jokes that don't really fly that well. They're just, it's not, it's dumb.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wasn't that into it.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't dislike it completely, but I was just like, this doesn't need to exist.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think it would be better if you didn't make it into a dumb comedy, if you just made like this crazy kind of almost narrative, like biopic kind of thing about the real action part.
Yeah, yeah.
And just make it like this crazy thing. I think I'd be more into it that way than I am by what's delivered here. So, you know, if you like Johnny Knoxville, you might get a few chuckles out of it. But, you know, I'm glad I watched it on Netflix, because there's no other way I probably would have watched it. Yeah. Like, I'm glad it was like 11 o'clock at night and I was like, you know, I want to watch something quick and easy. Oh, Johnny Knoxville. Press play. And then when it was over, I went, huh, Johnny Knoxville. Okay. Remove it from my list and move on. That's basically what it was.
I wonder why they never made another Jackass movie.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's not like I know Ryan Dunn died. And
it's not like Bam Margera's doing anything. He's just getting divorced and getting in trouble.
Yeah.
It's not like there's anything else going on with him.
Yeah.
Because I actually kind of like the Jackass movies, to be honest.
I did too, yeah.
I mean, I saw all three of them in theaters.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Johnny Knoxville's just so inherently likable.
Yeah.
That's the reason I watch this. But I, like I said, I can't recommend it just because it's so stale.
Mm.
And just is trying way too hard to be something it's not. Like, huh. It was just like a lark on Knoxville's part where he's just like, let's try and get back some of my Jackass glory, but let's do it so that it's an actual movie so that, you know, it might get released, because I don't think Jackass would get released these days.
Yeah, I mean, it's too bad, but like, I know when the trailer came out, like when it came out originally,
I
was kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
But then I will admit, when I saw it pop up on Netflix, I was like, oh, cool. Well,
I was the same way.
And I probably will watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, I was the same way. When I saw the trailer, I'm like, that doesn't look good.
Yeah.
But then when it popped up on Netflix, I was like, eh, what the fuck not? Why not? Right? Yeah. So, I mean, there's going to be people like me who did that, but it's not great.
Yeah.
It's not awful, but it's not great. It's mediocre, which seems to be a theme that's going to be running through most of my stuff tonight. So, action point.
All right. Well, okay. So, I decided to watch Bride of Frankenstein again, because I'm kind of trying to revisit some of these movies, and I'm trying to revisit some movies and part of why I watched Godfather 2 as well, like just some of these movies that I know have a really good reputation that I've just not really seen. And I've seen Bride of Frankenstein a long time ago, but that I just never really, like, I didn't really get it the first time. I wasn't like, oh, this is the best. Yeah, this is another one where everyone's like, oh, this is the best Universal horror movie.
This is better than Frankenstein.
And I didn't feel like that when I first watched this, and I didn't feel like that the second time I watched this. So, I mean, it's still a great movie. 1935, directed by James Whale. I did remember parts of this that I didn't think I would. Like, this one opens with a conversation between Mary Shelley and Lord Byron. And Mary Shelley's played by Elsa Lanchester, who, of course, plays the bride, which I thought was kind of cool. And I did remember from the first time I watched this. And Colin Clive returns as Victor Frankenstein, and Boris Karloff returns as Frankenstein's monster. It pretty much picks up right after the original Frankenstein. We're introduced to a new character named Dr. Pretorius, played by Ernest Thesiger. And he's like this, you know, kind of bad doctor who's trying to persuade Dr. Frankenstein to Victor Frankenstein to make a bride for the monster, and to make another undead creature that's brought back to life. And I didn't really like this character, and I think that's part of why I'm not super into this movie, because the first one, I was just so into Colin Clive and his, like, crazed performance that's what really, really sold me on the first Frankenstein. And he's got a much more subdued role in this. A lot of it I found out later was to do with the fact that he'd injured himself, so he had to be sitting through most of the movie. So he just wasn't able to be as animated. But I also thought his role was toned down a little bit, too. And I think that's why I'm just not that into this movie. It's still a great movie, but and it's Karloff's got a lot more to do in this movie. Like, you know, he's Frankenstein's monster learns how to speak a little bit in this, and there's a scene involving a blind man where he, you know, that's where he kind of learns how to communicate, and you really see a lot more to the monster than you do in the first one. Well, the first one, he still had his moments as well of kind of having a personality, but that's kind of brought up a little bit more. But I almost felt like it was almost too much. Like, and then the bride, like, you know, it's an iconic image, and her makeup and her hair and everything is definitely iconic, but there's just not a lot going on there either. And yeah, I think James Whale's direction is really great, and as it was in the first movie. And I love the way that, you know, he uses shadows and he uses his sets and close-ups and everything. Like, I do love the way that he does direct. And from that perspective and from a production design perspective, it's fantastic. But just story-wise, I'm still 100% with the original Frankenstein, probably as my favorite Universal horror movie. And that's after multiple viewings of this. So I just don't understand why people think this is the best. And have you seen, you've seen most of the Universal
it's
horror?
It's been,
right?
A really long time.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like it really made that much of an impression.
No, the thing is that when I say it's been a really long time, I mean it's been a really long time. Yeah. Like, I saw them when I was really young, and at that time I didn't really appreciate older movies like that as much as I probably would now.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't have a big impression of a lot of them, to be honest. Like Creature from the Black Lagoon, I still do, because that was my favorite at the time.
And it's still really good, right?
And same thing, like Frankenstein, I remember a lot more than I remember Bride of Frankenstein, to be honest. Like, Bride was, you're right, it's the image of her image is the one thing that you take away from that movie. And then apart from that, I don't really remember a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have a thing where I'm like, I kind of have this like project I'm trying to give myself where I want to revisit the Universal stuff because I have most of it. And then I'm waiting for a Hammer box set from the UK.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of hit the Hammer movies at the same time, and I want to kind of pepper those into my diet, because I'm kind of like you. I feel like it's kind of like, not more so for me, it's more of a kind of a miss for me. Like, it's just stuff where I feel like I should be a lot more aware of these things than I probably am.
Right.
Because it's been so long. And now that I'm like, when I saw them, I was like a teenager, or like early teen years, probably. Like, it's been 25 to 30 years since I've seen them. So now I, as an adult, I'm like, I think maybe I'd appreciate them a lot more now. Right. So I've kind of given myself this project where I want to try and get around to those two. And that's why I bought the Hammer set that's got the 21 movies in it. And then I've got the Universal set that came with the busts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
From like 10, 15 years ago. And it is a blank spot for me, this movie, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's I think the Universal ones, like, some of them I think are pretty good. And then some of them are going to be super boring. Like, I find the Bela Lugosi Dracula.
Yeah, I don't find that to be that exciting either.
It's got some really good moments, and he's pretty good, but it just, you know, for a 65-minute movie or whatever, it should be really fast, and I feel like that's drags on a bit. I don't feel this way about Frankenstein, but I saw the double feature of Frankenstein and Dracula a few years ago when they did them in the Cineplex theaters.
Yep.
And yeah, Dracula is kind of like, okay, fuck, let's get to Frankenstein. You know? But yeah, Bride of Frankenstein is just, it's just so revered. Like people just go crazy about this movie. And I've just not really gotten it. Like I've just not really, it's not really resonated with me in that way, which has been unfortunate, but it's still a really good classic horror movie and very, very well shot. I mean, James Whale was a master filmmaker that was influenced by, like, you know, the German expressionist cinema and stuff, and you can see that in this movie. But yeah, I just it's just not one. If I'm gonna go back, I'm gonna go back to Frankenstein.
I know that the old Dark House that James Whale directed with Karloff.
Karloff in that? Yeah, and yeah,
that's on
that. The guy who plays Pretorius was in that as
That's on Shudder right now, and that's one that I want to kind of see. I've never seen it, but that's another one that everyone really puts on this kind of pedestal too.
Yeah.
So I think maybe I should check that out too.
Yeah.
While I'm at it, but yeah, I do have a little bit of a blank spot when it comes to this stuff because it's been so long for me.
Yeah.
Like so long.
Yeah.
So, fair enough.
There
let's,
you go.
Let's, Jesus Christ. So you and I both love Roger Corman, obviously. We both love Roger Corman's contributions to the filmmaking world, especially the B-movie world. And you've been slowly working your way through his Poe adaptations and stuff.
Yeah.
So while you're doing that, working your way through classic Corman, I've been doing shit like, hey, remember when Roger Corman produced a bunch of movies for Sci-Fi Network in the early 2010, 2011? Yeah, let's watch one of those. So I watched Camel Spiders from 2011. Oh, God. You know, this other, he produced a couple movies for Sci-Fi around this time, like Dino Shark, which wasn't good, and Sharktopus, which I haven't seen, and then
I've seen Sharktopus.
Yeah, yeah, and then Camel Spiders. I'm like, hey, okay, so it's directed by Jim Wynorski under his usual pseudonym of Jay Andrews that he uses.
Yeah.
I'm like, how bad can it be? Well, it's not very good, I'll tell you that much. See, the problem is, this is the thing. When Roger Corman was running New World Pictures, and it was all practical effects, and he had that drive-in audience to strive for, the movies were fun.
Yeah.
This is Roger Corman being lazy with his production company, saying, this is just going on TV. Let's get some mediocre CG artists to do the monsters. Yeah. Let's just film in one or two locations and be done with it.
Yeah.
Let's do a 10-day shoot or whatever. And, you know, let's get like maybe one or two recognizable names to fill out the cast while we're at it. Right. And, you know, I don't want to discount Jim Wynorski because he has contributed a lot to B-movies, but this is another case where him and, like, Fred Olen Ray and that, I feel like after the 90s left, they've been kind of stuck in this cycle of doing these, like, forgettable, mediocre kind of TV movies or, you know, nothing special, let's be honest. Yeah. And so this movie just, it starts with this really dopey gunfight in the middle of the Iraqi desert. I'm assuming it's supposed to be, it's the Middle East.
Well, because there was that freaky picture, remember, back in that camel spider picture.
This
remember
is
that?
Is based on like the real spiders that
and
are
that
in the
was
Middle
in
East.
The Iraqi war. Yeah,
yeah. So it opens with that, and it's supposed to be the Middle East, but it's obviously just some fucking part of the desert in Northern California or wherever.
Yeah.
And so it's got them, it's got American soldiers shooting it out with like some Iraqi insurgents. And there's like dopey, like friggin' CGI muzzle flashes and like really bad looking helicopters and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm like, okay, whatever. You're starting your movie off with this. It's not terrible, whatever. And then these title spiders just come over the mountain behind these Iraqi guys and murder them. Just to mess it up, and they're just really bad looking CG where it's the kind of CG where it doesn't even blend in with the actual live action.
Oh yeah.
It just looks like they've taken like, remember those things we had when we were kids that were like transfers where they came on that clear piece of plastic and then you ran the pencil over them and it would transfer. It's kind of looked like that. I don't know, the color forms or whatever the fuck were called.
Not chloroforms.
Color forms. I think they were called color forms. Not chloroforms. But I'm just like, that's what it looked like. So I'm like, okay.
So are they giant spiders?
They're giant spiders. And they kill the Iraqi guys. And the American soldiers
like
hear...
Like them giant? Like that big?
Not quite that big.
Okay.
Probably like the size of a dog or something.
Okay.
So they kill the Iraqi soldiers, and the American soldiers hear the Iraqi soldiers screaming, and they're like, huh, they're screaming, and they're not shooting us anymore. Wonder what happened. They go over there, and they're like, there's no spiders in sight, and the soldiers are gone, too. So they're like, I don't know what happened, right? But while they're doing that, one of these smaller camel spiders crawls into the mouth of one of the dead American soldiers to be transported back to America.
Oh.
So that the camel spiders can start attacking people. Into the picture comes Brian Krause from Sleepwalkers, okay. among other movies, as an army captain, and C. Thomas Howell as the sheriff of this small southern town.
He's and always reliable.
He actually is the best thing about this, I gotta admit.
Yeah.
C. Thomas Howell is pretty fun in this movie. He's got the southern accent going on. He's got the mustache and the cowboy hat.
I think he's still awesome.
He's just that kind of thing, but he's not in it nearly as much as I wanted. Yeah. So, you know, they're in this small town, and then it becomes kind of like a camel spider slasher movie in a way, because there's random victims early in the movie that get attacked. Like there's these 20-somethings that go party in the desert, and they get attacked by the camel spiders. And the camel spider's, like, badly leaping in CG on people's faces and stuff. And I'm like, color forms! And, you know, and they're doing that, and just, like... And then, like, see Thomas Howell and the soldier guy find out that they're in town because they go into the general store, and they see the shopkeepers trapped in these webs, and they're like, help us! And it's so fucking hilarious, because I'm like, this is bad. So, you know, and this girl opens the chest freezer, and the camel spider jumps out and leaps on her face, and I'm just like, this should be more exciting than it is, but this bad CG is really taking me out of this, right? Yeah. That's the thing. When it was practical effects, I was way more in. Now that it's just bad CG, I'm automatically checking out right from the get-go, pretty much. Because I'm like, no. Because at least with bad, even if it's bad practical effects, at least your cast is reacting to something.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, it's just like, no, it doesn't look. This dude is Asylum-level CG.
Oh.
Okay, so that got to tell you something. And then it's just like, from there, it just becomes like, it just follows these people in the diner and these people who are holed up in a house as they're trying to escape from the camel spiders who are tracking them down. And it's just a lot of characters just sitting around between attack scenes, blathering all this stuff we don't care about. And, you know, it's got lots of these, like, soldiers and everyone shooting the spiders in this low-scale action sequences. And, you know, and it's not terrible, but it's just so cheap and just so poorly done with the CG. And it's just kind of boring in the middle. And I'm just like, okay, Jim, you've made good movies in the past. And here I just feel like you're on autopilot.
So he's like, got to have, who's this giant breasted starlet?
There isn't really one in this.
Really?
This is a sci-fi movie. So.
But it's a Jim Wynorski movie.
I know. So in that sense, it is kind of toned down. I mean, there's the typical Wynorski-looking female stars in it. You know, the ones who look like they've had too much collagen and enhancements.
Yeah.
They are in this movie.
Okay.
But they don't do any of the stuff you'd expect them to do in a Wynorski movie.
Interesting.
So that's there. But it's just, you know, my favorite part of this whole movie is the final scene. So that's, you know, I also felt like I had to sit through 80 some minutes to get to that final scene that I liked. And the only reason I liked that final scene is because it reminded me of old Wynorski and reminded me that, like, Wynorski made fun B movies.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, it's better than Dino Shark, which I've seen from this series. But it's just, man, I'm just like, I'm glad I paid $1 for this DVD. Like, Anchor Bay released this stuff on on DVD when it came out.
Wow.
And Blu-ray. And I have Sharktopus at home, and I'm just scared.
Yeah.
So, and not good. Not good.
All right.
Just expect which... If you like these kind of sci-fi shit shows, like sci-fi channel shit shows, like, you know, Sharknado and fucking three-headed shark attack and, you know, all those kind of things, like Lava Lantula and stuff like that, then whatever, have at it. Just not for me.
Yeah, I do pepper one of these in every 6 months or so, but...
I pepper one in, and then when I'm done, I regret it.
Totally.
That's the problem.
Yeah, we're both sick in that we force ourselves to watch the whole movie, even though they're shite.
Yeah, we're not the Netflix generation where if we don't like the first 10 minutes, we turn to something else. We sit through these fuckers because of video store culture.
Yes, we do. Okay. I reviewed a movie on the site.
That's the first review in 5 months.
Yeah. So we also, in case you don't know,
we sometimes write about stuff.
Sometimes write about stuff on thevideograveyard.com. So yes, it's been a while. So I decided to write about Spring Break. I'm yawning. Yeah, actually, it was pretty good. So from 1983, directed by good old Sean S. Cunningham. And I don't usually associate Sean S. Cunningham with Spring Break, but he did this movie. And I think I've seen Spring Break a number of times in my life. And every time his name pops up, I'm like, oh, shit, I've totally forgot about that.
As I said on the Facebook post to your review, this movie should be called What Sean S. Cunningham Did on His Summer Vacation.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So this is kind of one of the definitive... spring like bikini movies, and we had a whole episode on bikini movies, and I think we both talked about this pretty much right away when we were doing that episode. And you know, it's of its time, and
it's got a memorable ass poster.
It's got definitely a memorable poster, and it's definitely not politically correct. It's definitely not feminist.
No.
It's 80s movie about partying and drinking and just having a good time. And it, you know, back in those days, it was different. You know, I mean, you wouldn't do this today, but back then and back, you know, when we were growing up, this didn't seem like this nefarious movie. It just seemed like that's just what teenagers did. And it actually kind of, you know, for like a young male, back in those days, it was kind of like, oh, that looks really fun. You know, this was before I like dyed my hair black and painted my nails. This was when I was like, you know, young and impressionable and 14 and horny, you know, and I liked this movie quite a bit then. And I guess there's a bit of nostalgia factor for me in that, you know, it's very, very 80s. And, you know, some of the actors in it, I'm saying, you know, a lot, some of the actors in it, were pretty iconic at the time. Perry Lang, who played Adam, he was probably one of the more obnoxious yet likable frat boy, like characters in movies. He popped up in a few movies like Jocks and Alligator and Mortuary Academy, but he was just kind of one of these guys that was kind of recognizable, and in this movie especially, I really was kind of drawn to him, even though he's not someone I would really hang out with, but just some about the guy.
Can I just say I'm stunned you brought up Mortuary Academy of all friggin' movies?
I was like looking at his filmography, and that just seemed like one of
Mortuary Academy. Is that he was? It's directed by. What's the guy's name? Michael Schultz, I think, or something like that. And it's the same director as a movie called Out of the Dark, which is like this 80s slasher movie with Divine playing a detective.
Really?
Yeah, it's a pretty great movie.
Oh, shit. I got to see that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So I'm just stunned that you brought it up because I thought I was the only person who's ever seen that movie.
Well, I was looking for movies he starred in.
Oh, okay. He's the main guy in that. Okay.
Perry Lang starred in, but this was definitely his biggest role. And he went on to become a director. He directed a Dolph Lundgren movie called Men of War, and he also did a bunch of TV stuff. David Nell plays Nelson. He's kind of the main focus of this movie. He's this, you know, kid who's... his dad's a politician, and he's realizing that he's, you know, out of high school, and he's, you know, he's gonna have to grow up pretty soon. So he's never really let loose. So he decides to go to Fort Lauderdale with his buddy Adam.
Never happens in '80s.
Played by Perry
Beach
Light.
Movies ever.
But he was pretty likable in this. I liked him a lot as well. And
that's the thing about a lot of these movies, yeah. Like we talked about in the Beach movies. It's like they could be doing stuff that's totally sexist and totally like nefarious activity, but in the 80s we're like, yeah, he's pretty cool dude, you know. And we never,
but they weren't ever doing like rapey stuff.
Well, you
like,
know what I mean, but they were like, they were just,
but they were going to like wet t-shirt,
yeah,
contests,
like,
and
horny kind of like,
yeah,
you know, like wet t-shirts and like just ogling women on the beach and like trying to get their take their trying to like sending a dog to take their bikini tops away,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Pretty innocent, really. Like, it wasn't like they were like, haha, I'm gonna roofie this girl. Like,
yeah,
it,
they didn't
that
go
stuff
they didn't
not,
go cause beyond them or anything.
No, it's just they were at parties and everyone was drinking and they were like trying to get laid, and that's just,
yeah, but
that
a
was
lot
a
of them were like kind
then.
Of these dorky but likable kind of guys in these kind of movies who had like the oppressive parents and needed to cut loose.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then there's these other two guys that show up, played by Paul Land and Steve Bassett, and they're like kind of like cool older guys, but even they were pretty likable in this as well. Particularly, well, both of them were. Paul Land was this kind of like Italian, like, you know, sexy dude who would like take his shirt off at all the time and wear a Speedo and show off his stuff. And Steve Bassett, he was kind of like the dumber, the kind of dumb, almost jockey guy, and he would, you know, he had this headband and he was like kind of being portrayed as a kind of the dummy of the group, but still like probably the hottest of the group too. So he was getting the hottest girl in the movie goes to him. Jane Modine plays Susie, who's the girl next door who David Nell's character Nelson falls for, and very, very likable as well. And that was the thing. Like I thought the women in these movies were, especially the main love interest, was usually pretty well cast and someone that, you know, when you were young, you would want to kind of get with, and not because they were like sexy and you knew you could have sex. It was more like they seemed like someone you would actually want to hang
next
out
door
with,
who were in amongst all the wet t-shirt contests,
and they were cool and nice, and you wanted to someone you'd want to hang out with.
The girls who made the guys who were going to the wet t-shirt contest and everything realize that maybe there's more to life than partying.
Well, and someone that the nerdy guy could attain.
Yeah,
I mean, they meet when she's playing Galaga,
right?
And he's giving her tips on, like, that's how they meet.
Galaga's,
I love that.
Galaga's my favorite arcade game of all time, just so everyone knows.
And I love that. I think that's really cool. Corrine Elphin, aka Corrine Wall, who ended up marrying Ken Wall, she was a penthouse pet. She plays Joan, who's the singer of the all-girl band Hot Date, and that's who the Steve Bassett character is going for. And she, you know, the band had their, you know, typical, there's always seem to be girl bands in these movies as well. Yeah. But she's wearing like spandex and it's very revealing. And the music's not very good, but still kind of weirdly catchy.
So it's kind of like the band in Hard Bodies.
Well, that was Vixen. And
were they called in Hard Bodies?
I can't remember.
Oh, it was a weird
name. At least
too.
They were rockers, but, you know, seeing a female singer in pink, like a pink spandex bodysuit, just seemed weird to me. But she went on to be in a Sergio Santiago movie called Equalizer 2000, and she was also in the classic Hot T-shirts.
The Chuck Vincent jam.
Yeah.
My body is wet.
Yeah.
My body is dripping wet. If you've seen the movie, you'll understand.
I know. I kind of regret selling the VHS. Weird story. Tammy Lynn Liepert, who plays this, she's got a very, very small scene in this movie. She, there's a scene where there's a female boxer, like, fighting different, like, jocks who go into the boxing ring. She, and she's also reportedly the cover model on the iconic cover. Mm. she went missing. Like, she was also in Scarface. She had a pretty memorable scene, very brief but memorable scene in Scarface as well. And she went missing just into thin air, like the year this movie was released, and has never been found. She just was like this aspiring actress. She was going to move to LA. She went to some party, and it sounded like she saw something bad at this party. Like, I don't know what, but it sounded like she saw like some sort of illegal activity happening, and then thought she was being pursued by like someone out to get her, and was getting like more and more paranoid about this. And eventually, you know, was freaking out, was put in a psychiatric hospital, was released, still freaking out, still thought someone was out to get her. And then one night just went out and went out with someone, got dropped off on the side of the road, and never fucking seen again.
Weird.
She was on Unsolved. The story was on Unsolved Mysteries. And yeah, just a really bizarre story. Yeah,
that's weird.
It's really weird. So you can actually check out the Unsolved Mysteries episode on YouTube, and I thought it was quite fascinating.
I might have to watch that.
Yeah. There's a Robert Stack version, and whoever took over Unsolved Mysteries,
yeah, I can't I'm not remember sure. who it was.
Okay, you can also look for Jeff Garlin in this if you're a Curb Your Enthusiasm fan. He's the guy, one of the main contestants in the belly flop contest. You'll notice him right away.
Also, and, if you're a Goldbergs fan.
Oh, is he in that as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, he's the main guy. Main parent in that show.
Man, belly flop contests. Like, I actually saw a belly flop contest.
Like a real one?
In the real one.
There was so many of these movies, though, in the 80s with belly flop contests.
Yeah, but I remember going to, there was this place called the Coach House in North Vancouver, near where we live. And I remember going there with my dad for some reason, and there was some fucking belly flop contest. And it's one of those memories that I'm just, because I think I was young, and I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, what are these people doing? And my dad's like, oh, they're having a belly flop contest. Yeah, very, very vivid memory of my
youth. I can't remember what movie it was. I think it was like Summer Job or something, where they did a belly flop contest where they fucking sent the dude up on a scissor lift. So he was like so far up in the air that when he did the belly flop competition, it almost cleared the pool of water.
Whatever happened to belly flop contests?
Oh man,
like do they ever happen anymore?
I don't know, we should bring them back.
We totally should. We should have a spring break themed bar night or something.
Like belly flop contest, wet t-shirt contest, and jello shooter and
banana eating.
And we're also going to play some Bananarama in the background at Vixen.
And B-movies fans will also notice Nikki Fritz pops up in a, or pops out in a brief scene.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. What else is in this? Yeah, we've talked about the wet t-shirts. We talked about the drinking, the bikinis, you know, but yeah, people aren't a lot of people aren't going to like this. We've talked about this at length in our in our bikini episode, but I still think this one was pretty good for what it was. And again, really, really anchored by the David Nell character and his really, when that relationship starts with the Susie character, you really, I really did find it quite engaging. I'm not a big fan of the whole like politician dad who's like out to like shut down the hotel. Like, again, we see this in all of these movies, but I did find this, the relationship, I was quite into that. And unfortunately there wasn't enough of it. And all the characters were very likable. So this is still a pretty good example of this genre, if you're all curious. But it is, yeah, again, there's a lot of ogling.
And if anything, even if you're not that curious about it being a beach movie from the 80s you haven't seen, you got to be goddamn curious that this was directed by the guy who made Friday the 13th.
Yeah, totally.
Like, this is an anomaly on this dude's filmography.
Yeah.
Because he made Friday the 13th in 1980. He made A Stranger is Watching in 1982, which is like this crazy, like, crazy kidnapping fucking thing about where the guy kidnaps the girl's young daughter and hides out in the fucking New York subways.
Yeah.
And then you've got this movie, Spring Break, and then you've got The New Kids with James Spader after this. So it's a real fucking weird movie to be wedged in where with all those three.
Yeah, it really, And I've never really, you know, I've heard Sean Cunningham be interviewed, but this movie doesn't get brought up. And I don't know why, because this may have been his biggest movie. Like, this was a huge hit back in the 80s. So, yeah. Interesting. So if I ever get to interview Sean Cunningham, so we'll be talking about his Spring Break.
We'll be talking about Spring Break more than Friday the 13th. He's talked out on Friday the 13th anyway.
I'm sure he'd love to talk about Spring Break.
Yeah. Is there a theme song in this at least? I don't remember.
The girl band has a few songs, but I can't remember what they are.
Because, like, you remember how also in these 80s, like, sex comedy, beach comedies, there was always a song that said the title of the movie?
Yeah.
So, like Weekend Pass was like, Weekend Pass, gonna get a Weekend Pass, and all this kind of stuff. Like, they all had these fucking songs.
There definitely is a song because it's done by Cheap Trick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I can't.
I actually have the vinyl soundtrack of this at home.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder if the girl band's on there.
I don't know.
Hot Date, that's what they're called.
I'm gonna have to check it out.
Hot
now.
Hot Date.
I forgot I have that record.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'm gonna.
Has it got the iconic Sands of Iwo Jima?
It does. But it's like, it's. I remember it's pretty scratched up because I got it for like $1. And the only reason I bought it, because it was before I started recollecting vinyl, was that I bought it so I could frame it and put it on the wall. Because I was like, yeah, this fucking poster.
Yeah.
So I have to see if they're on it.
I'm sure Cheap Trick's on it.
Trick is, but I have to see if this girl band's on there, and then I can jam out to it when I'm doing notes to the next episode.
Totally, yeah.
All right, well, I'm gonna talk about a documentary. So I watch a lot of documentaries. I mostly watch entertainment-based documentaries because I'm a nerd and I like the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
So when I watched Bad Reputation, which is the Joan Jett documentary, there was a trailer on it for a bunch of other ones. And there was one on there called Love, Gilda from 2018, which is what I watched, about Gilda Radner, who was a comedian who is most famous for being on Saturday Night Live as one of the original cast members. So she was on Saturday Night Live, I think, from 1975 to 1981, I want to say. I'm not sure on the years. And then she also was known for being later in her life for marrying Gene Wilder from, you know, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and Your Favorite Woman in Red. And
oh, yeah, she was in that. I forgot.
Yeah, she was in that, and so was he. He directed that movie, too. And then, so this is kind of like, I've always known about her, but I've not known a lot about her. And the way this is structured was shown in the trailer, and that's what made me intrigued by this, because it's directed by Lisa DiApolito. And what she has done is she's made a portrait of Gilda Radner as a person and what she went through and all that by using old footage of, like, you know, home movies from when she was a child, footage from when she was in Second City with, like, Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase and all those, Saturday Night Live footage of her doing some of her more famous characters like Rosanna Dana and things like that. And then also sound recordings that she had made on cassette tapes that were like kind of a personal diary kind of thing. And then actual diary entries that Gilda Radner's actual diary entries to just kind of go through, you know, her childhood, how she went from, you know, got the urge to act and become a comedian and Saturday Night Live, and then kind of going through her later life because she died fairly young of cancer.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes through all that, and it's the concept and the way that it's structured that I really was intrigued by this. And I actually really liked the way it was done in this, because the thing is, when you watch a lot of entertainment documentaries, a lot of it is just talking heads.
Yeah.
And that can get a little bit trying at times, because you got like a, you know, a 90 minute movie to, you know, a 2 hour movie where it's just a lot of talking head interviews. And if I want that, I can just watch special features on any Blu-ray I own or whatever. So when I'm watching something that was actually released as a standalone, I kind of want something that's a little bit different that will keep me engaged.
Right.
And that's what this did. And I did actually learn quite a bit about Gilda Radner as a person, because I've always kind of found her to be intriguing, because she was like
one of the few female cast members in the 70s on a show that became, you know, a big deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in that landscape, a female comedian to be successful was kind of a little bit more of a task than it is these days,
yeah,
to be honest. And then she was always just very unique looking, and she had a very unique personality. And she did a concert film in 1980 called Guild Alive, which I actually quite enjoyed, where she filmed a live show, like a one-woman show, basically, in New York, mm-hmm. and it was committed to film. So I did learn a bunch about her, and, you know, the only thing I kind of wished was that, because this is only running like 86 minutes, there was a few things that were a little bit more glossed over than I probably would have liked. Because, you know, she had struggles with eating disorders when she was in college and university and all that, and that's not really touched upon that much. And then even the stuff with her having the cancer and everything is kind of not, I mean, I know it's a depressing thing, but it was kind of not really that touched on as quite as much as I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
And even her relationship with Gene Wilder, I felt wasn't touched upon as much as it should have been, because Gene Wilder, even up to the day of his passing away, had said, even though he remarried and everything after she died, he's always said, Gilda Radner was the love of my life. No one ever compared to her for me, ever. She was my soulmate. She'd always be my soulmate. So I'm like, well, if you have this story that's supposed to be like this huge,
yeah,
romantic kind of thing, why wouldn't you kind of flesh that out a little bit more?
Yeah.
So that we're aware of that. Like, it wasn't really touched upon quite as much as I thought it would. And I mean, it's got to suck being whoever married him after she died, because you're always getting compared to her and everything. If the love of his life or whatever. But I mean, for something like that, where in Hollywood, couples don't have that connection a lot of times, I just think that would be interesting to have a little bit of insight into why they had that connection and why that worked for them, you know? And because, you know, you always want to hope for happy endings for people and stuff. And it's just something that I think would be interesting, because when you're constantly in the spotlight, I'd imagine it would be hard to find that kind of thing, right? So I did enjoy this quite a bit. I mean, it's not like one of my favorite entertainment documentaries I've ever seen, but if you're at all intrigued by who she was and what she accomplished, it's worth seeing for sure.
Nice.
Like, I was super curious, because like, I didn't know a lot about her going into this, and now I feel like I do have a little bit more appreciation for her, and I do want to kind of see some more of the stuff that she's done. And I know that the Guild Alive is available on DVD from Warner Archive, so okay. I might pick that up, because I really think I should. I think that's known as being like the best way to familiarize yourself with her comedy.
Right.
And what her like strengths and talents were as a comedian. So yeah, huh. I recommend it if you're into this kind of thing for sure.
Cool. All right. I don't even know where we're at here. All right.
You don't know where we're at? I could tell you where we're at.
Okay. I watched another classic. Well, not. Yeah, it's a classic. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
So you're watching all these classics, and I'm just watching garbage like Camel Spiders.
I know, man. I don't get it. But so I revisit. This is another revisit. A little movie called Christine.
Nice.
From 1983.
Honestly, I feel the John Carpenter movie that needs to get more love than it does.
Yeah, you know, and the reason I watched it is because it's the John Carpenter movie that I'd never remember as a John Carpenter movie.
Well, yeah.
Like, it's like, I never, kind of almost like the Taxi Driver conversation earlier. Like, it's just one of those ones I just kind of forget about.
Well, because there's so much, like, They Live, Halloween, Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
There's just Escape from New York, you know? There's all that I feel like this is the movie that people kind of forget.
Yeah.
That he was involved with.
Yeah, and it's a good movie.
It's one of my favorite King adaptations, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, way back when we did our Stephen King episode.
Yeah.
Episode 2. Please don't listen. God, I wonder what that would be like to listen to now.
Anyway. I'm not even going to bother, dude.
I'm kind of curious.
Awkward, I'm thinking.
Yeah, remember back then, we were like, oh yeah, we'll be confident one day.
One day.
Oh, memories. Okay. So this
anyone
is
who's been with us since episode 2, thank you.
cricket. So this is the tale of young Arnie Cunningham, a high school nerd who keeps getting beaten up by good old Buddy Repington.
Yep.
And his gang of hooligans. He's got a best friend named Dennis, played by John Stockwell. And it seems like Arnie's destined for a life, a kind of a shitty life of being unpopular at school and having a crappy time at home, until one day Dennis are driving along and they see this, Arnie sees this old car, this old Plymouth Fury, and they pull over and he decides to buy the car. And who does he buy it off? Roberts Blossom, who played Ed Gein in Deranged. So you already know you're off to a bad start when you're buying a car off Roberts Blossom.
And it's love at first sight.
It really is. And I could see what he liked about the car, and it's trashed, like the thing's a piece of shit. So he takes it to a place called Darnell's, which is a kind of like a body shop where he's able to work on the car, and he makes a deal where he's able to work, kind of do extra work around the shop to in exchange for being able to use parts to fix up the car Christine. And eventually he does, and then they become, Arnie and Christine, the car, develop a pretty unhealthy relationship where he's basically falling in love with the car. Meanwhile, he's also kind of, he also, not kind of, he totally changes from a nerd into kind of a cool guy. And he ends up hooking up with Alexandra Paul, who plays Lee. And but she's constantly jealous because Arnie's like caressing the car like she wishes she was caressing her. And there's, you know, much fighting ensues, and it eventually leads to tragedy. And it's a good flick. I mean, we talked about this also on the Killer Cars episode. And I felt like it dragged a little bit, like near the end, because the ending involves like heavy machinery.
Yeah, the finale
was like, it wasn't very fast moving.
Yeah, the finale might have been a few minutes longer than it needed to be.
Yeah, but I definitely enjoyed the buildup. Definitely enjoyed when Christine the car, started to go on a bit of a killing spree. It's a great flick, but yeah, it did kind of lose me a little bit at the end. I just thought it was an odd choice to be using heavy machinery in a battle. Like, it just was a very I'm talking like a forklift, or no, not even a forklift, like a bulldozer, and it was just a very slow moving battle, and thought it slowed the movie down a little bit. But
And then this was my introduction to George Thorogood's Bad to the Bone, and that's a fucking song that has been overused in so many goddamn movies since Christine. I think Christine did it first.
I think it did, and it's also cool because there's a lot of 50s music, but it's both.
And it's used really well in this.
Yeah, we hear the actual 50s music, but then when we're in the current, like the 80s where the movie's set, we also hear 50s music, but in 80s.
Yeah.
Like updated for the 80s, which I thought was kind
of
neat.
Well, and then a lot of it too is Keith Gordon's character.
Yeah.
He's great in this movie, by the way.
Yeah, he is.
Like, his transformation is so well done.
Mm.
And also, to tie in with the 50s theme, he kind of starts looking like a greaser from the 50s, and it's just a really cool decision because it's Christine taking influence over him and kind of molding him into how it was when she was a young car, I guess, because it's a 57 Fury. Like, it's just little touches like that I really appreciated about this movie.
Yeah, and it's like with Gordon's performance as well.
Yeah, he's great.
And he's talked about how he, like, was when he was touching Christine, he was pretending he was actually touching a woman.
Yeah.
And so it really comes across that he's like kind of getting off on the car a little bit. And the 50s thing kind of weaved its way throughout the whole movie. Yeah. I mean, Buddy Repington, one of the best villains, I will say, of 80s horror. Like, I love this character, and I just, he's not in a lot, but he's just makes such a huge impression.
We still quote Buddy Repington to each other once in a while.
We do. And he is played by William Ostrander, and he was in a few things, but not a lot. But holy shit, this character just makes such a good first impression, and every time he's on screen, he just totally owns it. And I love this character. But he's also like a 50s, him and his gang.
Yeah, he's kind of
him in particular. He's definitely like a 50s greaser.
Yeah, he's kind of meant to be like that too. And just some of the effects work in this is really good too.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen Christine, but you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If you've seen it or you're going to see it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about when it happens.
Exactly. Gordon went on to become a director.
Yep.
He directed a movie called The Chocolate War that I really liked, as well as a movie called A Midnight Clear and other stuff. Stockwell also became a director and went on to make Blue Crush, Into the Blue, Turistas, and the Cat Run movies. So he's kind of... I kind of like John Stockwell movies. He's kind of... They're these...
I take exception to Turistas, but the other ones are okay.
They're kind of testosterone-y, fun... I don't know. They're kind of like B-movies with an A-movie director. I don't know.
Yeah.
Alexander Paul, of course, went on to Baywatch. And I still like... She was just so gorgeous in this movie. And I find it hard to even... I just don't picture that woman on Baywatch as being the same woman that was in this. I used to get her confused all the time with Catherine Mary Stewart from Mary the Comet.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's just gorgeous. Harry Dean Stanton shows up, Robert's Blossom, as I talked about earlier. Robert Prosky plays Darnell, and I'm bringing him up because he was in a movie called The Lords of Discipline, which I've talked about before, which one day we're going to talk about and do an episode kind of relating to it. Because there's another character in this, Moochie, who is kind of the chubby Buddy Repington gang member. He's played by Malcolm Dinar, who is also in Lords of Discipline. And if you've seen Lords of Discipline, you would recognize both of those actors. Malcolm Dinar was also in Heaven Help Us. And Popcorn, and he easily played like the chubby 80s character. A lot of 80s movies had a like chubby comic relief character.
No.
And finally, we get Kelly Preston in a small role, but oh my god, it just brought me right back to Mischief.
Dude, this is primo Kelly Preston time, 83 to 86.
My God, John Travolta, I don't understand. Anyway, that's Christine. So, if you're looking for a John Carpenter fix and you want to keep going back to The Thing and Big Trouble and Halloween, then maybe you should...
You should watch Christine because... Definitely out of the horror adaptations of King's work, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's one of the ones that I can go back to way more often than some of the other ones, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right, well, let's loosely tie my next movie into Stephen King.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about Children of the Corn, Genesis.
Oh, no, I forgot.
From 2011.
Oh, fuck.
Okay, so... It's been 10 years since Children of the Corn Revelation was released. And this was basically Dimension Pictures being like, oh shit, we're going to lose the rights to Children of the Corn. We better make a movie. They did the same thing around the same time with Hellraiser. We're like, oh, we're going to lose the rights. Let's quickly crank out a movie so we can maintain the rights for a little bit longer. So what they did this time is they brought in Joel Sasson, who is a sequel specialist.
Yeah, why do I know that name?
To write and direct. How you know that name, Josh, is this guy is responsible for either writing or directing entries in the Prophecy series, the Pulse series, the Mimic series, the Dracula 2000 series, Hollow Man 2, Piranha 3 Double D, co-directed Maniac Cop 3, and also was one of the writers on one of my favorites, Trick or Treat from 1986.
No.
Yes.
I know him from for some other reason.
He also made a movie recently called Cam to Cam, which a lot of people watched. Oh, yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that, yeah.
But yeah, you know he's one of those guys where his name pops up and you're like, oh, fuck, this guy again. I'm sorry, Joel, but it's true. So this time, you know, keeping the... this movie opens in 1973 with a prologue that has this Vietnam War vet returning home. And he comes to the house and there's nobody there. And he's like, Mom? Dad? Sis? Can't find anyone. Walking through the house. And every once in a while you see that thing where there's like someone just runs across in the background really fast. You know, that kind of shit. And then he finds Dad with a bunch of corn cobs in his eyes, dead. And he finds the rest of the family dead. And then there's an evil kid there, and he backs up to the top of the stairs because he's on the second floor, and the evil kid's there, and next scene, he's falling out a fucking window.
The evil kid or the guy?
No, the guy.
Okay.
He's at the top of the stairs, and he falls out a fucking window. Think about this for a minute.
I heard you.
I don't understand what the fuck happened. There's no fucking window at the bottom of the stairs. So how does he fall out of the car? He should have fallen down the fucking stairs, not flown out a window.
Exactly.
So anyway, he flies out a window from the top of the stairs. And then from there, it comes to modern day, and we have this couple played by... we've got a pregnant girl called Allie, played by Kellen Coleman, and her boyfriend, Tim, or I think he might be her husband, played by Tim Rock. And they're driving through the California desert.
Tim Rock?
That's the guy's name.
All right.
And they're driving through the California desert, and their car breaks down. So they're like, oh, shit. We're in the middle of nowhere. We need to get a tow truck or something. So they, you know, wander down the road a bit, and they end up at this kind of like ranch, but it's really run down and everything. And when they knock at the door, it's answered by the next B-level actor to take a turn in a Children of the Corn movie. We've got Billy Drago from Invasion USA, among other things.
Oh, Billy Drago.
And he's playing...
I'm surprised it took him till here to show up.
I guess. And he's playing this preacher type who is on the ranch with his mail order bride. And
Billy Drago has a girlfriend?
Yeah, she's like a mail order bride because she's like this like Russian lady, and she's like kind of sort of hot and younger than him. And I know she's a mail order bride because she soon tries to fuck Tim when Allie's not looking. But anyway, it turns out that the Billy Drago character is the guy who flew out the fucking window at the beginning of the movie, who has gone on to become a religious zealot. Who sort of talks about He Who Walks Behind the Rose, even though in this movie there's no goddamn fucking corn and there's no goddamn fucking killer kids.
No, there was corn at the beginning.
No.
You said there was corn cobs in the guy's fucking eyeballs.
That's it. There's no fucking corn. I want fucking corn stalks and fields of corn for people to run through and get lost and get killed. There's a kid on the cover of this fucking video box holding a scythe in a cornfield. That's not in this fucking movie. So anyway. So, you know, he sets these rules down for a couple. They're like, oh, we could either walk so many miles to a town or we could wait till tomorrow for a tow truck. So can we stay at your place? So Billy Drago's character's like, sure, you can stay at my place, but there's rules. He's like, you can't leave the house to go snooping around the property and, you know, don't get in our way, basically. So, you know, Allie, being pregnant, middle of the night, she says, I gotta go take a pee. Goes outside to use the facilities and the outhouse and sees a shed, and it's like something's going on in that shed, and finds out there is a small boy trapped in the shed being held captive.
Wait, this is the pregnant girl?
Yes. Fuck. So she finds out there's a kid being held captive in this shed from there, the script becomes this mishmash of telekinesis, nightmare sequences, and Allie's character kind of like Billy Drago's character being like, I might want your baby now. I haven't decided. And, you know, and the Russian mail order bride trying to fuck fuck Allie's husband a couple times. This movie makes no fucking sense. This is almost as bad as 666.
Oh, this sounds bad, man.
It was a slog to get through. I hated every fucking minute of this. I don't understand why I'm done this to myself for 8 fucking movies. I'm happy that there's only one more to go, which was made in 2018. And it seems like it's another one of those we need to keep the rights kind of movies. And I also found out it's fucking written by Joel Sasson.
The
new one.
Oh, God. You're almost done, man.
I don't want to talk about this one anymore. I just want to say that Billy Drago is not slamming a prostitute's nose down on a straw while she's snorting coke and throwing her out a window like he did in Invasion USA. He's not fighting Chuck Norris like he did in Delta Force 2. He's not looking creepy in the background like he did in countless other movies he was
Vamp,
in.
Yeah.
He's not co-starring with Roddy Piper in an action movie like he did in the past. He's just fucking cashing a paycheck. This movie's bad. Really fucking bad. It makes a little bit more sense than 666. But this is down there. This is like the bottom barrel of the Children of Corn movies.
Wow.
And if you've been listening to me talk about these fucking things for the last 5 episodes or 6 episodes, there's not much to look forward to in this series apart from Urban Harvest. And that was 5 fucking entries ago on the front. By this point I've sat through fucking 5 other fucking movies since Urban Harvest, and there's been nothing positive.
No, so, there hasn't. There were some boobs in one, I think you were talking
about. Yeah, part 7, the last one. At least that had a girl being attacked in a bathtub by corn stalks. At least that had fucking corn stalks in it, okay? This has nothing. This has nothing to do with nothing. What else?
Whoa, nothing to do with nothing.
Nothing to do with nothing. No Children of the Corn, no Killer Kids, no fucking shit all to do. He Who Walks Behind the Rose. If you talk about He Who Walks Behind the Rose once, that does not make your movie a fucking Children of the Corn movie.
No.
So, no.
It was probably like a 80-yard line.
Yeah. He Who Walks Behind the Rose. And then No. One more to go.
Wow.
Thank goodness. You're fucking welcome. I'm saving everyone from watching this shit.
You are. You're like, I always had this dream I'd watch every movie ever made. And you've made me like decide, you know what? I can watch every movie ever made, but I don't need to watch
the children. Dude, I'm saving you from 8 movies. Because you've seen the original. But I'm saving you from 8 movies.
That buys me a day of life.
I honestly don't think that it's going to get much better from here.
You think?
The only thing I have about part 9, Runaway, is that it's directed by John Gallagher. Is it John Gallagher?
Yeah.
Who did Feast.
Yeah.
And, well, he did Piranha 3DD, which I didn't really like, but Joel Sasson wrote that motherfucker too, so that explains it. So, yeah, tune in next episode for the conclusion of Children of the Corn.
Now, I don't agree. I think you should have to watch the remake as well.
The one with... No, fuck you. Yeah, no.
I don't think this is complete until you've watched
By this point, by this point...
You have to watch the remake.
No, fuck off.
No, come on, man. It's just one more.
But
I really do think you need to...
Dude, like, it's out of sequence now. Sorry.
You're not going to feel good unless you...
I don't fucking feel good already.
But you're not going to feel closure.
I feel empty inside when I watch these movies.
You need closure, man.
I don't need closure.
You do.
No. My closure is when the fucking credits roll on Runaway. That's my fucking closure.
No, because now you're going to be like, but that remake, dude, it's going to be...
You need fucking closure. Where's Lake Placid versus Anaconda?
I already reviewed that. I'm waiting. I got the new one. It's
gonna Lake Placid Trinity or whatever.
It's on fucking VOD. I'm gonna watch it.
Oh, do you watch Tanacon? I don't remember.
I did.
Oh, okay.
I've already sold it.
Oh, fuck.
But no, you need to watch the
You
remake.
Need to watch Hellraisers.
I'll watch maybe.
Are we going into the? I'm not watching the remake.
You are watching the remake.
No.
Look, I had to watch the remake.
I have spent enough fucking money on this series by now that I'm not doing it. No more money is going into the coffers of anyone who has anything to do with Children of the Corn.
Oh, people are going to be disappointed though, man.
Oh, I'm sure. If you're disappointed that Chris isn't watching the 2009 Children of the Corn remake, go to our Facebook page and let me know.
And see, man, you gotta like say something, dude.
And if you do, don't be surprised if you get kicked out of that group.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm not doing it. Run away and that's it. Sorry. We'll see.
I'm sad.
You're not fucking sad. Do you want to actually sit through me talking about two more instead of one more? Come on.
I do.
It's out of sequence now.
I do.
The remake's 2009. This is 2011.
I do, and I think other people do as well.
No. This is like when you collect Blu-rays that have numberings on the spine. I just can't do it out of sequence. Sorry.
Okay.
Oh, God. One more.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I took a Chris recommendation. And I've figured out. Okay. So, The Mist. I really love the movie The Mist.
Uh huh.
There's a character in The Mist played by Marcia Gay Harden.
Uh huh.
Who's like bonkers.
Yes.
Anyway, I think I've seen the prequel. And that's a little movie called She's Too Young.
You watch this? Awesome.
So if you ever want to know why Marcia Gay Harden was the way she was in The Mist, I think it's because of what her daughter put her through in this movie.
Dude, I think every adult character in this movie is fucking belongs in a loony bin.
Okay. So this is a Lifetime movie.
I think everyone in this movie belongs in a fucking...
This movie is like a fucking masterpiece. This is what I would call a teen sploitation masterpiece for the new generation.
So guess what, you guys? I got syphilis. Dance, 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 dance.
Okay, so yeah. So, okay, 2004... Directed by Tom McLaughlin, the director of Jason Lives.
My favorite Friday movie.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, yes, syphilis. This movie involves syphilis.
Yes, it does.
If you're going to watch this movie, get yourself some, like, Jack Daniels and take a shot every time the word syphilis. Actually, well, you could do it with beer.
Dude, you could be drunk in the first 15 minutes.
You could do it with beer. They say the word syphilis so many times in this movie, it's absolutely ridiculous. Second of all, this movie takes place in fucking Halifax.
Yeah, I was wrong. I was actually wrong when I first talked about this movie. I think I said it was New Brunswick.
No, so it's Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I'm glad you corrected me.
In the Maritimes in Canada.
Like, or I might have said it was Saskatchewan. I know I screwed up where it was
set. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I knew it was like Canadian province. That's all.
Yes. And yes, we have a listener.
Us up here aren't too aware of that syphilis.
We have a listener named Michelle in Nova Scotia. I wonder if she'll like know any of the locations. I wonder if this was shot there. Like, I wonder
if she could tell us if there was a syphilis outbreak.
No,
there.
But there was and... this is based on a true story. It didn't take place in Halifax, though.
Why the fuck would?
Why would you have like a true story somewhere in America? I'm sure in like fucking Nebraska
Florida.
Or some shit.
Florida.
Oh yeah, Florida. Probably Florida. So somewhere in Florida, there was like this. syphilis outbreak in a high school. So why would you then be like, okay, this happened in Florida, but you know what? Let's just write a script about this, but we'll set it in Halifax.
Where can we film a movie for cheap?
But I don't. Did they shoot it in Halifax?
I have no idea.
I'm super confused. So yeah, very, very, very strange.
I'm so fucking happy you watched this. I just gotta say,
the music was by Mark Snow. Mark Snow did the X-Files theme. Like, what the hell was he doing? Like, this is so confusing to me. Did you watch the special features, by the way?
Yes.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Okay, so this movie, okay, let's get back to the plot in case people haven't heard Chris's discussion.
Oh my god.
Okay, so the movie is oh, it's so awesome. Okay, so the movie is like, it takes place in this high school, and I guess that the way you become popular in this high school is you have to blow someone. If you're a female, and it seems like it's only the females. Like, the guys don't have to go down on people to be popular. The only way you get popular is you blow, like, the popular dudes.
No, the only way you get popular is you have a threesome.
Oh, no, that happens. No, you get popular by blowing.
But then when you do a threesome, you reach a new level of popularity.
That's true. That's true.
When you're 14, threesomes are so fucking common. At least in this movie.
Oh, my God. So there's, like, this really nice, and they're played by Alexis Ziana. She plays Hannah. She's, like, the very, very nice girl, great home life, fucking cello player, great student, gets good, really good marks. And, you know, one day she's going out for ice cream with her friends and the bad boy, Nick. Fuck, I've never met a Nick I liked either, by the way.
Nick the dick.
He's Nick. But he's one of those.
Yo, I'm Nick. Won't see my dick.
Yeah, it's just one of those names. Like, it's one of those. Like, I'll say, I had an uncle named Nick. He was a cool guy. But other than him, like, Nick's, like, they're just, it's just, if I ever found out my girlfriend was, like, going to be hanging out with some dude named Nick, I'd be fucking there. I wouldn't allow that to happen, because Nick's, yeah, it's just not a good situation. Anyway, Nick, she decides she's gonna hang out with Nick, who's like kind of who by the way had just fucked her friend. Who just fucked his friend, and her friend's like, this guy right away. They're about to have, they go to a motel. Okay, so there's so much happening in this movie. So they're going out for ice cream. Nick,
loving this right now, just so you know.
Nick's driving. They're going out for ice cream. It's fucking Hannah and her two friends. They're going out for ice cream with Nick. So off they go, and then it gets to the, like, ice cream parlor, which doesn't look like an ice cream parlor. It looks more like a drive-in, kind of like the drive-in in American Graffiti or something, but not, like, in the 2000s. And, you know, as soon as they get there, all of a sudden, like, the, like, distorted guitar comes up, and then the camera starts, like, whipping around, like, oh,
like they're at a fucking rave.
It's bad news. We're at the fucking drive-in diner
ice cream parlor. They're evil.
At one time, there was, like, a close-up on, like, a hot dog or something. No, but it wasn't a hot dog.
Dude, that's foreshadowing.
That would have made more sense. It wasn't a hot dog. It was, like, something totally random. Like, and I'm like, why did
a bumpy pickle?
I feel. No, it wasn't something sexy. It was like, and I'm like, why did they? And I just like, just, so there's all this distortion. Like, oh, so we know the kids, like, it's like the bad place where all the bad kids are. The parents don't go there. Bad shit's going to happen. And bad shit does happen, because Nick takes one of Hannah's friends. I think he takes, was it the other girl, I can't remember her name, the one from Degrassi. Anyway, takes one of them to a fucking hotel. Like, they go to a hotel to fuck, and the girl's like, do you have any protection? He's like, I'm sorry, baby. Well, I guess I could leave and if you want me to, and go get some. And she's just like, no. And then they fuck. And of course she gets, and he's got syphilis. He's like,
I would also like to know how a 15-year-old can rent a hotel room.
I was wondering that too. Like, I wish we got to meet the owner of the hotel just so we knew what kind of character that we're dealing with. Like, it was really kind of gross. And then, yeah, like,
I guess in Halifax, anything goes.
I guess so. So,
listener in Halifax, does anything go in your province? Please tell us.
No, it's not like that in Halifax. I know other people in Halifax. Halifax is a kindly area.
I know. I'm just, this movie makes it seem like it's a fucking
really
sex show.
It's like a fuck fest in Halifax. Anyway.
Halifax fuck fest. That's my new punk band. Dude, want to form a punk band? Halifax fuck fest. We'll have a song called just syphilis.
Fuck. Okay, so they fuck at the hotel. He doesn't use a condom. Everything's cool with that. So then the next day, I guess he like hits on Hannah somehow, and Hannah's like, he's like asked her on a date. That I guess everyone's just cool with this. Like that, basically, this guy fucked the friend the night before, and now Hannah's wants to go out with him, and the friend's just like, yeah, that's cool, whatever. I don't really feel much for him anyway, whatevs. So off Hannah goes with him, and this guy is such a sleaze. Like, I'm just like, oh, you're such an asshole. And he, like, you know, he's like, they go to a party, and like this party, oh my god, like they walk into the party, and like fucking all the guys aren't wearing their shirts, like no one's wearing their shirts, and they're all just fucking making out, and then the camera like whips over, and there's coke, and then it whips over, and there's fucking joints. And then there's alcohol, and fucking everyone's drinking, and it's just, oh my god. Like,
I don't remember this when I was that age.
Oh my god. Yeah, I never went to a party like this. It was like terrifying.
You're lucky if it was fucking Cheetos and Diet Coke.
Yeah, but if you're gonna look at fucking Sean S. Cunningham and give him shit for spring break, you need to watch this movie. Okay, so then they, you know, they're at the party, and it's all, and he's like, oh, let's get out of here, it's too loud or whatever. So he drives her. Where does he drive her? Oh, to his parents' house. No one's fucking home. And then immediately he's like, well, I'm gonna go in the jacuzzi. And she's like oh, okay.
And
then she goes and gets changed and comes and fucking goes in the jacuzzi with the guy. And I'm like, what the fuck, lady? So she goes and goes in the jacuzzi with the guy, and then of course he's like a pro, right? Like he's like, well, I'm not even gonna try and kiss you, and she's like, oh, you're not? Well, I'm gonna try and kiss you, and it's just like, oh fuck, like you're just so stupid. Like, don't you know? And of course, then I'm like, no, of course she doesn't know. She's 14. She doesn't fucking know. But this guy fucking knows. He's well aged beyond his years. Like he's learned.
This guy's like fucking Don
Juan. He knows everything. He's, yeah, he is. Well, they call him the Casanova of the school.
How could he know all these things? Pornhub didn't exist back then.
He knew how to be an asshole. So he must have watched like Pretty in Pink or something. But anyway, the guy knows how to like treat ladies like shit, and he knows how to get them to have sex with him.
I'm protected.
So then they don't end up hooking up that night, but the next time they go out, I can't remember where they were. Anyway, she feels like she has to blow him. So she does, she blows him. And then immediately after, she's like, well, what is everyone going to know that I blew you? And he's like, well, yeah, everyone's going to know just by the way you're acting, you know, like the way we look at each other or some shit. So she's feeling conflicted. And then, you know, it's, and I felt really bad for her. I'm like, yeah, you have to blow the guy to like feel like you're popular. And it seems like that's what you
have
to do.
That's the whole school did, though.
You blow, you're popular. You blow, you're popular. So
the whole school's just fucking bomb.
But what are I just don't understand how the guys get popular. Oh, no, they don't. If they're not getting blown, then people think they're gay, because that's the one character
right.
They keep calling him gay, right?
Right, right, right.
But he's like figured out this way to fuck everyone over by using his camera phone and threatening to call the cops. Okay, so then we've got
so much to unpack in this.
The blowing
movie.
Happens, and then it's revealed that the girl who fucked Nick at the beginning has syphilis.
Yep. And how does she reveal it?
How does she reveal it?
They're doing that thing.
Oh yeah,
where they're doing a dance, like they're dancing for her little brother. Like, look at us, look at our dance. And the weird. Little brother goes, do we look hot? And the little brother's like, hot, hot, hot.
Yeah, I forgot about
they're
that.
Dancing. And watch this clip on YouTube, and you'll watch this movie. I guarantee it. Just put in like, just put in She's Too Young dance scene and you'll fucking, you'll watch this movie. You'll buy this movie. And she's like, guess what, you guys? I got syphilis.
Totally. It's totally how it happens.
Like, she's all proud of herself.
No, she's not proud, but
then, she acts like it. Like, oh, big deal.
And the other two are like, oh. And then the one girl, what's her name? Becca. She's like, oh. And then she's like, kind of like, isn't cool with the other girl having syphilis. But then Hannah obviously is like, oh, I just blew Nick. Okay. I'm going to have syphilis now, too.
Quick question. Is this before? Does her syphilis reveal come before or after she has a three-way?
She doesn't have the three-way.
The other one does.
Becca has the three-way.
Oh, okay. She's all upset about fucking syphilis, but she has a goddamn three-way.
Becca knows she's going to get syphilis, but she doesn't care because she just wants to be popular. Like, she's the one that really, really wants to. She's like, in Heather, she's like Heather number one, right? So she, like, wants to be the most popular of the popular.
Okay, okay.
Whereas, you know, the one from Degrassi, Miriam McDonald, I didn't write down her character name, but she was in Degrassi, The Next Generation, and she was also in Poison Ivy, The Secret Society. Which I've also seen. But she kind of feels bad for getting the syphilis. And then Hannah is kind of stuck in the middle because she's blown Nick and you know, then feels the bumps in her mouth. And it's like, oh, fuck.
I like how every time he's saying blown people, he's doing the motion with his hand, just so you know.
I totally am. Okay, so then it gets even more fucked up for poor Hannah because then Marcia Gay Harden gets involved.
Uh-oh.
And she's like Hannah's mom, and she finds out about the syphilis outbreak and decides that she's going to start the parent group to try and, like, inform the teens and the parents.
But the problem is this parent group has no fucking idea of the real facts about syphilis.
They don't. They really don't. And it's just there's a parent group meeting, and there's just, and it's got, like, these different characters that you've never seen before piping up, like, oh, I think syphilis is terrible. And then like, this asshole guy, like, one of the dads, he's like, well, I'm proud of my son. He's getting it on. You know, like, I'm just like, what the fuck is
Halifax
happening? And then Marcia Gay Harden's just getting crazier and crazier. And, you know, there's, like, these fights going on with her and Hannah. And you're just, this is where you're seeing the seeds of the chick from The Mist. So, like, Hannah must have been left at home when the fucking mist came, and Marcia Gay Harden just ended up.
Or she died of syphilis.
I don't know if you could die of syphilis. I know you could die of syphilis, but no, in the movie you can't, because that's what.
Do you remember they sent a flyer home with everyone? You, it's a syphilis
epidemic. They did, and remember Becca was like, "Well, fuck it, I could just go get a shot." And Nick has the same attitude.
Yeah,
because someone's like, someone confronts Nick, one of the nurses, and she's like, Nick, you need to get tested.
Whatever, just give me the shot.
No, he's like, I don't need to get tested, and this wick's been in every candle around here, or some shit like that. It doesn't say that, but it's something like that, and he's just such an asshole, and I'm just like, oh my god, dude, you are such a prick. And yeah, he has no problem, like, he's been fucking getting his lance waxed left, right, and center.
I almost fucking spit my beer out.
don't spit your beer out. Anyway, and then I forgot about Stalker Nerd. So Stalker Nerd is this guy, like, who's got this, the hots for Hannah, and he's like, he was in Diary of the Dead, which was a pretty good movie.
I gotta watch this shit again.
But he's like, yeah, he's like into Hannah, but he's like kind of stalking her throughout the movie, and then he actually gets to be able to hook up with her, and then pushes her away and says, no, we don't need to do this right now. But of course, she's now, because she's been with Nick and blown him,
she thinks blowing equals boyfriend.
So no, but she now thinks that, like, if because Stalker Nerd Guy doesn't want to get blown, that she's, you know, there's a problem. So, and then, but then Stalker Nerd does kind of end up rescuing her when she's about to get, sorry, spoiler alert, she's, you know, she's in a really bad situation where someone's trying to basically force himself on her.
This is Hannah we're talking about. And Stalker Nerd shows up with his flip phone. He's like, you get away from her, one button, and this picture's going to 911. And I'm like, that's your threat, dude? Like, why don't you just go punch the guy out like someone would in an 80s movie? But no, because we're in today's day and age, that's what he's going to do, is he's going to take a photo, and that's how he's going to get people. Which I guess is somewhat relevant this day and age. Anyway, that's She's Too Young. Scariest Parties Ever. Just an epic movie that I thought was totally fun. All I was wishing is I wish I was watching it with someone.
Oh, man.
This would have been so much more fun.
I can guarantee you, I watched it with my girlfriend, and we howled through the whole thing.
Oh, my God. And the best part when after I watched it was... The reviews on Letterboxd, did you read any of them?
No.
The reviews, there's a few on Letterboxd, and there's a couple on IMDb. And they're like, so I had to watch this in my high school.
Oh, yeah. I did see class. Something like that, yeah.
So, yeah. That's all it would say. So apparently this was used in high schools as like a scare video. Kind of like Scared Straight when we were growing up, right? And I think that's like pretty weird. But it also seemed that young people were kind of connecting with what was going on. So, which is also fucking terrifying. So anyway, this is something else. And good pick, dude. I'm all over Lifetime movies now. I made a whole list of them that I want to watch.
Dude, I've got more at home. I can give you Baby for Sale.
Oh, you have Baby for Sale?
Oh, fuck yeah, I do. Dana Delaney and Hart Bachner, Baby for Sale.
I watched the trailer
for Baby. You're damn right I got Baby for Sale.
Was on this. I think Tom McLaughlin might have directed Baby for Sale.
I've been getting a lot of these fucking Lifetime movies, man. Holy shit. How could you not?
This was awesome.
You know what?
It's like a whole new world.
You know what scene was amazing? Was when that one friend was having the threesome, the other girl stumbled into the room and she's like, they wanted her to join in or whatever.
Yeah.
And she said no. And the other friend just gives her this look like, yeah, I'm fucking two dudes.
Totally.
That was so funny.
Yeah. And she does it later too. She has another threesome later.
Seriously, everyone, buy this fucking movie. That's all we got to say.
If you're into exploitation movies, and yeah, like this one, the one girl was in Degrassi, The Next Generation. The other girl, the threesome girl, she was like one of the leads in Secret Life of the American Teenager. Very popular TV show. Maybe that's why this resonated with young people. But holy crap, like this thing was just bonkers. So highly recommended.
Oh,
with
awesome.
A friend.
I'm so glad you watched that. Okay. Well, I can't top that. Let's talk about 2018's The Ranger.
Oh, I watched The Ranger.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. We can both talk about it.
Oh, cool.
So this is a throwback slasher movie from Glass Eye Pictures, which is co-founded by Larry Fessenden, who is one of the cool indie dudes that we like to see pop up in movies. And he does show up in this movie playing the main girl's uncle in flashback scenes. So what this is, easiest way for me to describe this is it's an 80s slasher that wants to be Green Room, basically, is the way I look at it. Because it starts off with like a flashback of a girl sitting with a ranger and he's having this conversation with her, and the cops show up. And he's like, don't be scared. And that's all you really know. Flash right. forward to a punk club with a bunch of punk kids with the typical names. Like one of them's called Jerk and so on and so forth. And then they end up having to go on the run because one of them accidentally kills a cop. And they end
up... asshole dentally kills a cop.
Oh, is that what they say? Asshole.
No, that's what I say.
Oh,
the guy,
asshole
dentally. Cop did not need to die. It was because the guy was such a fucking dick. Like He killed the cop.
But
like,
that's the thing,
it was
dude.
Totally unnecessary.
But that's the thing. This movie is full of fucking dicks. Not literal dicks, just people who are terrible. And we'll talk about this. So they end up having to run away after one of them kills a cop, and they decide that Chelsea, played by Chloe Levine, who's the girl from the opening scene when she was younger, she has a cabin in the woods. So they're like, oh, let's go hide out there.
Yeah.
Which they do. And, you know, anytime you go to a cabin in the woods and you're in a horror movie, it doesn't really spell good things for you. So they end up starting to get picked off by a psycho
park ranger played by Jeremy Holm. And from there, it's just slasher movie tropes till the finale, basically. That's basically the whole plot. However, there are elements to this plot that I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, there's a scene in this, like, okay, I like slasher movies. I like 80s slasher movies. I like certain things this slasher movie did. So, debut feature by Jen Wexler, who has worked on previous Glass Eye Picks films. You know, pretty good practical effects for the most part.
Yeah.
A really fucking messed up scene involving a wolf skin that I thought was a little bit outrageous, but I enjoyed. And then, you know, the Jeremy Holm guy just like, you know, walking around the movie, cracking one-liners and singing Charlie Rich's The Most Beautiful Girl song over and over again. I was super amused by. And I actually thought Chloe Levine was pretty good in the lead. But apart from that, we got assholes.
Yes.
I don't like anybody in this movie apart from the lead girl because they're all jerks. They're jerks to each other. They're jerks in what they do. And fuck, there's a scene in this where that makes it really hard to care about these characters when, you know, one of the girls gets shot by the ranger. And instead of trying to help her, what they do is they shoot her up with fucking drugs and say, this will ease your pain. I'm like, who fucking does that?
Yeah.
Like, seriously, give me a fucking break.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if your point is to make me not like these people so that when they die, I'm like, yeah, but come the fuck on.
Yeah.
Like, give me a break. Like, it's stuff like that that I did not like about this movie. And I also didn't like the fact that it's really gets to a really slow start. Like, I thought this movie took a long time to get rolling. It's a fucking 80-minute movie, and it felt like it took forever to get to the kills.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I know some slasher movies in the past have done that, but for this, it doesn't work. And, I mean, I know she's trying to keep our interest by having quick cuts and neon colors throughout the movie and everything, and I'm just like, that's fine and dandy, but I really think everyone in this movie is an asshole.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes me be like, who cares? Which is kind of my attitude about this whole movie.
Yeah.
To be honest, is like, who cares? And the finale was really weak.
Yeah.
Like, really weak. And holds it back. Like, there's so much stuff in this that holds it back that all the stuff that I did enjoy is kind of canceled out by the stuff I didn't. What's your opinion? Because you watched it too, so...
How did you watch it?
I watched it on Shudder.
Okay.
They added it to Shudder.
Well, I bought it. I have the Blu-ray. Oh,
that's unfortunate.
Okay, so my opinion. So when it's... Okay, when I put it on the Blu-ray...
Yep.
The music that's playing under the menus...
Yep.
...is I Used to Be in Love by Diglow Abortions.
Yeah, that... Yep.
So I was like, oh, okay. So I'm going to be... I'm like, holy fuck, the Dayglows, like, no, yeah. People don't even know about them. They're like a band from out here.
Yep.
And, I mean, I guess people know about them, but not really. And I was like, holy shit. That's,
people don't go around singing Fetus a Fetus like we do.
That, yeah. So I'm like, oh, that's pretty awesome. This is going to be cool, right?
Yeah.
But then, yeah, as soon as it started, I was pretty quickly really not into it. So, okay, there's a movie called SLC Punk.
Yeah.
So in my history, I've had a lot of friends and known people that are in this world. And so I've been exposed to it quite a bit. And I've never met punks this much like assholes in my, like, they're people that are in this world that at least that I've been exposed to have not been like these characters, which I find very, very frustrating. Like, because this is kind of really, it's like a movie that was made about punks that by people who don't really understand that world.
Well, exactly, because even in Green Room, they weren't like that.
No, Green Room, I bought them a lot more.
Yeah.
So, and it seemed really weird to me that, like, Larry Fessenden seems like someone who would understand that. And even Jen Wexler, like, I just feel like, I felt like the people making this should have known better. So unless maybe in the East Coast they're totally different than out here, this was not reality, at least from what I've been exposed to. Most people I know that are into this or that are punk rockers are cool. They're not fucking drug crazy, and they're not assholes. And all of which, like, this portrayed punk rockers, other than Chloe, as, like, just total prick junkies, like cokehead fucking
idiots.
Well,
yeah, because they were snorting that drug called Neon or whatever the fuck it
was.
And they were like,
didn't care. They were like killing cops just because they were killing cops.
Well, and the fact they were shooting up their friend to ease her pain. And
yeah, and I just can't imagine like a punk rocker I know saying, fucking pig. Like, I just can't imagine.
Well, and then anytime they went,
happening, like
anytime they went anywhere in this movie, they're like, fuck authority, man. Yeah. You know,
like it was just so like over the top. Like, now maybe they were going for that in some way, in some weird way, but it just felt really irresponsible to me.
Right.
Because you are portraying a subculture that is still around. There's a lot of punks still around. And I think it's just, yeah, pretty irresponsible because people that aren't exposed to that, and a lot of people aren't, right? I mean, a lot of people don't and haven't been around that. They're gonna maybe think that that's what these guys are like, and it's not. And I just, so I was kind of pretty pissed off right off the bat, right? Because they're in basically the scene where we're introduced to them all is where they're doing coke in this weird back room of the bar or the club. The one guy is like threatens someone, another, a woman with a knife, like right off the bat. Then they start running from the cops, and the one guy, the lead guy, who's such a fucking prick, his name's Garth. He's Chloe's boyfriend, which immediately made me lose respect for her, by the way. He shoots this cop, and there's like, it's, or stabs him or something. Anyway, it's totally unnecessary. And it's just like, come on. Like, you're totally demonizing these people. Like,
well, it's just a plot point to get them to the cabin. Oh,
it was fucking ridiculous.
They could have just gone to the cabin on a fucking vacation.
They could have. And then this guy is such an asshole to her throughout. Yeah, that's what I mean. I literally like was like, how am I supposed to care about her even when she's got like really like putting up with this shit? Like, this guy, he's such an over the top prick, and I think we're just supposed to buy into that. Oh, this is just how they treat each other. Like,
but even the friends were pricks.
Yeah. The friends were pricks, and then we've got like the token gay couple with the token black guy, and I just felt like everything just felt so contrived to me, and I felt that way about SLC Punk too. I just felt like it really wasn't really giving an honest depiction of that world.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jeremy Holm as the Ranger was fine, but I just thought he was pretty cookie cutter.
Well, he was, but I just liked him walking around singing that the most beautiful girl. I just was like, oh, well, that's kind of amusing, I guess.
Yeah. But I just, yeah, overall, holy letdown, man. I was so excited for this because there's just not a lot of movies about punk rock. And, you know, some of them are done well. I thought Green Room was done pretty good. I mean, I'm kind of hot and cold on my recollection of it. But I do know it's specifically with that world, it did a good job. I mean, I love Suburbia. But there's not a ton of movies that involve this. So I was like, oh, this is really cool that someone's made a punk rock horror movie. But no, they didn't. They made this weird, like, I don't even know what it is. But it almost felt like an exploitation movie that just totally didn't understand like what was going on. So I was super bummed.
It's just like I said, I know that the characters are fodder to be killed, but at least make them likable in some way.
Yeah, like make me care at all.
Yeah,
like, you know,
I really didn't care about this movie the entire thing either, to be honest.
I slightly liked her.
Yeah,
but
she was okay.
I just lost so much respect for her by her putting up with that shit. Like there's no way. Like how am I supposed to like her that much when I know she's just like a doormat?
Well, and it's like I always go back to this about this movie. You checked out early on, like when he was acting like a prick and everything.
First 5 minutes I was out.
I checked out when they shot up their friend.
Oh yeah.
I was like, fuck this. Like, you're seriously doing that in this movie.
See, I didn't have as much of a problem with that. Like, it,
I just thought it made no fucking sense.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Like, even the dumbest person in the world is going to be like, maybe I should tie something around them to stop the bleeding. Not, I'm going to shoot them up with drugs so that they have no pain. No. Even the most fucking lowly, dumbest, low IQ person in the world wouldn't do shit like that. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, maybe people exist. Like, I'm sure I know drugs exist and all that.
But well, I know, but...
Everything just seemed... Yeah. My word for this movie is obnoxious.
Yeah.
Everything just felt like the boyfriend was obnoxious. Shit like that. Like, it's just obnoxious. Like, it just felt... Anyway,
in other words, a double thumbs down on the Ranger.
Yeah, and it's really too bad because I really do look forward to. I mean, not anything, but I like it when there's a new female director up on the rise. I mean, I do like the style that we get a lot of those times from female directors. Not that I'm just specifically singling them out, but it's always a good thing to see, and just to see one that just didn't succeed like this is a real bummer to me. So I'm hoping she hits it next time. I mean, I don't know what happened here.
There were a few moments where I was like, oh, maybe. But
there were a few. Like, you're right. Some of the gore gags were pretty good.
Well, the wolf scene.
Yeah.
I thought the wolf scene actually worked pretty good.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, you're right. It's just pretty much a letdown.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, me again. Okay.
Well, this was your double, but we happened to both watch The Ranger, so.
Oh. So how many more do I have left?
Three.
Do I? Oh, yeah. Okay, my double. Okay. Okay, so I did another revisit. Seems to be my theme. And again, it was kind of a bit of a...
That's your theme, all right.
So this one, yeah, this one...
We'll always have She's Too Young.
We will. But this one was kind of a bummer because I had really... I don't know why I had fond memories of this. I don't think I've seen it a lot. I think I've seen it once or twice. Well, I know one reason I had fond memories of this, but... Anyway, I watched a movie called Creepazoids.
I know why you have fond memories of this.
But, okay, so from 1987, directed by Dave DeCoto.
Did you watch the 88 Blue?
I did.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I had really fond memories of this, mainly because of Linnea Quigley's in it, and she has a shower scene. So, from my, 14-year-old me that watched this, you know, from the video store, and when I figured out who Linnea Quigley was, and that pretty much every movie she had a shower scene, it was exciting. And then I loved monsters and B movies, and so this one in my head was a huge, like, one of the big ones from my youth, right? Like, of the video store days and discovering B movies and stuff. Creepazoids is one that's kind of in my head, as far as nostalgia goes, is one that really pops to mind.
And a lot of it could be the name of the movie and the artwork.
The artwork, the original artwork, was pretty awesome. And thank God it's flippable on the Blu-ray that 88 Films put out. It opens up with a great, you know, it's got the synth score. I think it's the same guy. I didn't write his name down. Or maybe I did. No, I didn't. The music writer also did the music for the composer also did the music for Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bolarama. So synth score, it's like, you know, got like this group of five like walking around in like the LA like underpasses and stuff, and it's supposed to be like the world where acid rain has like fucked everything up, and it's like post-apocalyptic, and I thought it was really good, like a really good opening. You know, they're just walking around and synth scores playing, and I was really into it. So then it starts raining, and they realize, you know, the rain is acid rain, so they need to get shelter to get out of the rain. So they run into this building, which looks like kind of like a warehouse that was they figure out was some sort of research facility, and they're trying to figure out what was going on there, but they're also realizing it's a pretty good place to stay. And so we've basically just got these five characters holding up in this place and just trying to figure out if it's safe. We've got Linnea Quigley's one of them. Of course, we know her from countless B movies, and she's always pretty fun. We've got three dudes, and we've got another woman, played by Kim McCabe, who is a.k.a. Ashlyn Gere. And the very, very, very famous porn star of the 90s. She's in this, and this was before she was a porn star, and she actually doesn't even take her clothes off, because when this movie was shot, she was so shy she refused to do nudity. So it's just bizarro to me that she decided to go that other route 3 years later. Anyway, they're in this place. We discover that it's actually a place to keep something in rather than to keep people out. So it's like a scientific research lab that's meant to quarantine something. One of the characters finds a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and as I was watching it, I'm like, wow, you know, a lot of our listeners probably won't even know what the fuck that is. So back in the day, we had disks that were literally almost 6 inches long that flopped around.
They were 6 inches and they flopped around, huh?
They weren't like the 3.5 harder ones.
And then when you shook them, they got bigger.
No, they didn't get bigger. But it did bring me right back to my
Commodore 64,
yeah. Anyway, he finds this floppy disk and there's like a diary on it. And then we realize that something bad was going on. Blah, 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 blah. Linnea takes a shower. Blah, 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 blah. Monster on the loose. So we find out there's a monster in the fucking thing, and then it's on the loose, and then the rest of the movie is literally some of the people getting picked off, and then like scenes of running up and down corridors, crawling up and down like air ducts. And yeah, I was really kind of bummed out. It was just kind of boring and lame. The finale went on forever. There were some okay practical creature effects, but you know Linnea, even I guess in my head, like I pictured that shower scene as a lot more than it was. It was literally like, you know, 30 seconds long, and there wasn't really a lot of gore, and that was the only nudity, and I just was like, why did I love this movie so much?
And there's a mutant baby that looks like it's ripped off of It's Alive.
Yeah, there's a mutant baby, and that's part of the practical effects, but that scene just kept going on and on and on, and it was just kind of struggling.
What's the running time?
It was like 75 minutes.
Yeah, and it's, when your movie's 75 minutes and it feels like it's dragging, that's not a good sign.
And I know I texted you last night and I was like, I'm going to try and fit one more in. This was the one. And that was at like 10 o'clock. And I was like fucking fighting to get through this. And I even like had, you know, I was starting to fade out and I rewound it. But it was just running around up and down corridors. It was really quite lame. So it just doesn't have the fun of like a movie like Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers or Sorority Babes in the Slam Ball Bowlerama or Slave Girls from Beyond Infinity. Like those were other ones from that time. And it sounds like those still hold up. Creepazoids does not.
I bought this Blu-ray too.
As did I, and I'm looking forward to like listening to the commentary and stuff, but I think it's just one of those ones that we just had the nostalgia so much, and we loved Linnea so much, and I think we've got that fucking cover ingrained in our brain.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's brilliant, because that's what I think the movie is, but nope, it's not.
All right, well.
It's not at all.
That's a bummer.
It really is. And the other big problem I had is it was way too dark. And I don't know if that's a problem with the transfer or not, but I think it's feasible that it just was too dark.
I think it's the movie, because I had the DVD of this too, and I remember that being kind of dark.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Have you seen it recently?
Not for a while.
Yeah.
I have the Blu-ray, though.
Yeah, so do I.
So
And I think that's okay. I mean, it's one you want in your collection, but I've definitely realized I don't need to keep my DVD and VHS that I also own of this.
No, you don't. You don't.
All right. And I guess I've got another one here.
No, you're not doubling.
I thought I was.
You got two left. I got two left.
You have two left. I have two left?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's my turn.
Your turn.
Yeah, because the Ranger canceled out.
Right. Got it.
Got it? Okay, we always have this problem, people. It's hard to plan who goes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so anyway, I went to the theater.
Oh, the theater.
And I saw a movie that just came out this past weekend called Booksmart.
Oh, yes.
The directorial debut of actress Olivia Wilde. I would like to describe this movie as kind of a female Superbad.
stars Amy, played by Caitlin Dever, and Molly, played by Beanie Feldstein, who is Jonah Hill's sister, as two smart best friends who, you know, figure out that, like, you know, we've been going through high school and all we've been doing is focusing on studying and, you know, we haven't really got a chance to experience the high school thing, like going to parties or, you know, having fun or kissing a boy or whatever. So it's the night before graduation. So let's go out and have ourselves a crazy night. We're going to go to this party. We're going to get drunk and we're going to make out with boys and whatever. And of course, this being a comedy, it doesn't quite happen that way. There's a lot of side journeys on the way to this party that go ridiculously wrong. And, you know, until we culminate in the next day at the graduation ceremony. And you know what? I really liked this one.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
I really did. I the thing is like, for me, comedy is kind of a crapshoot these days. Like, if it's not a dark comedy, I have a really hard time with new comedy and finding a movie that gives me consistent laughs through the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I might see a movie where I have one or two chuckles during it or whatever. Or I might have a movie like The Package where I liked, like, a good half of the jokes and then the other half kind of didn't work for me. I don't see a lot of movies where I'm consistently, like, kind of amused or laughing through the whole thing. This is one of the movies that did it for me. The only other movie recently I can think of that was like that would be like The Big Sick from a couple years ago and Game Night with Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. That one I thought was really good too. The thing about this movie is the two leads are great. They work really well off each other. I really like Beanie Feldstein. She was in Lady Bird last year. She's only been in a couple of handful of movies, but she's really got a really big, brash personality. And, you know, she you can tell she's Jonah Hill's sister when you watch the movie.
Is she the lead in Lady Bird?
No, she's her best friend.
Okay.
So, you know, there's those two. You've got all these raunchy humor going on through the whole thing, but, like, not raunchy to the point that it becomes kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Like, just raunchy to the point that you're just, like, sitting there laughing through it. Like, there's a scene involving, like, the one girl's parents are, like, super religious, played by Lisa Kudrow and, I can't remember the guy's name, Will Forte.
Okay.
And they, like, they're super religious, but they think that maybe their daughter's a lesbian, but they don't want to kind of admit it. So the other friends are always, like, doing, like, weird, awkward things in front of the parents to make them feel, like, uncomfortable. Like, she'll be, like, hugging her and be, like, trying to grab her boobs. Be like, we're just going to go out to the library and stuff and just to make them feel uncomfortable. So that's pretty funny. There's a scene involving a pizza delivery man, which is pretty fucking hilarious. And there's a scene in this where they take drugs and they end up imagining that they're Barbie dolls, which is pretty damn funny, where it's done stop motion animation with Barbies.
Nice.
That's really fun. It's really fun scene too. And there's scenes in this movie that get stolen by the supporting cast too. So Eduardo Franco, who was in The Package.
Yeah.
He's in this and he steals a bunch of scenes in it because he's like this dumb kind of drunk guy who has a crush on one of the teachers and always is trying to get with that teacher. And then you've got Billie Lourd playing this girl called Gigi. She's from American Horror Story and Scream Queen. She's the daughter of, I can't remember who she's the daughter of. She's daughter of a pretty big name actor. I can't remember. Oh, Carrie Fisher's daughter.
Okay.
She's just like this kind of like richy girl who's also crazy and she always keeps popping up in inopportune moments and getting into these situations and she steals almost every scene she's in.
Right.
And it's just, it was a really a big surprise for me because I was like, I was going into it thinking, you know, this might be pretty amusing and it's got good Metascore and everything. And the trailer didn't look too bad, but this actually exceeded my expectations when it was over because I really liked the leads. I thought it was really consistently funny through the whole thing. And if you like movies like Superbad or like, you know, those ones where it's like teenagers going on a night of wild adventure that goes wrong in so many ways. And
yeah,
you know, it's perfect for that. If you like those kind of movies, this is perfect for you. I do recommend it if that's your thing.
Nice.
So yeah, Booksmart.
This had you all written all over it when I saw the poster for it.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
What's that mean?
Just seemed like your kind of
you're
thing.
Like, that's a Chris movie.
Yeah.
And you're right, it was. I really liked it. And I say you should go check it out instead of going to see Aladdin, people. Aladdin made fucking $85 million this weekend.
Oh.
Booksmart made $5 million.
Really?
So please go
Aladdin did that well?
Yeah. Please go support a movie like Booksmart.
Yeah.
Don't support a fucking shit show like Aladdin.
Yeah. I wonder what the reviews are like for Aladdin.
Bad.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, it also makes me... Okay, so I gauge a lot of movies by Metascore sometimes, which is an average out of 100 for critics.
Yeah.
Aladdin has a 54 Metascore.
Yeah.
Booksmart has an 85.
Yeah.
Okay. Then when I look at Box Office Mojo to see their projections and stuff, they talk about something called CinemaScore.
Right.
Now, CinemaScore is a load of fucking bullshit. Because what CinemaScore is supposed to be is they poll audiences coming out of movies and tell it to give it a grade from A to F. And the reason I say it's bullshit is a movie like Aladdin has a CinemaScore of A minus or A. And a movie like Booksmart has like a B minus or something. It's always the pop. It's always the big studio movies with the special effects that audiences are giving A ratings to. And then real movies are getting like D's and E's and C's and F's. And I'm like, who are they polling? Are they polling like a theater in the middle of like where are they getting these results from? So I just find it really weird.
Yeah.
So go see Booksmart instead of Aladdin, please. I deplore you.
Yeah, no kidding.
And for a debut feature, I think Olivia Wilde handled it really well.
Oh, good.
So, yeah. Another woman director with a female cast, written by women. If you're on that train of supporting women artists, get the hell out and see Booksmart. It's well worth it.
Good.
Okay.
All right. Now we get to our little challenge.
Oh, our homework. I left my homework till last, so.
You did. You did. Thank God you did it. Anyway, we decided to ask each other to watch a movie that we wanted the other person to see.
So the story is, before you start, we were planning to do an entire episode of this.
Yeah.
Where it was like, each of us picks 5 movies that we have some reason or other that we want the other person to watch.
Yes.
So it might be like a movie that we really think will, you know, agree with the other person's taste, or a movie that we really love that we're like, why are you putting off watching that or whatever? And we were going to do 5.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of hesitation because we're like, well, what if someone ends up hating all 5 of the other person's movies or something? That's going to make it like not fun, or that's going to make it. So we're like, let's do an experiment and just pick 1 movie each.
Yeah.
So that's what we did here.
That's what we did. So my movie was Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
From 2016, directed by David McKenzie. Okay. Chris has talked about this before.
Yep.
So it's basically the tale of a pair of brothers played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster, who are robbing banks, low-level banks in very, very small towns in the U.S. I think it's supposed to take place in Texas. It is supposed to take place in Texas.
Yeah.
It was shot in New Mexico. It's supposed to take place in Texas. So it's they're just robbing these banks because they're trying to raise enough money because basically, their mom has died, and they've realized that there's oil on the farm, but they need to raise money to be able to buy the farm so they can cash in on the oil, and they don't have any money. So they've come up with the scheme that if they rob enough banks and they just take small amounts from the banks, that they'll have enough money to be able to buy the farm. That's your basic premise. So when the opening credits came up, I was pretty excited right away because I saw that the score was by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. Of course, Warren Ellis is one of the members of Nick Cave's band. He's the guy with the crazy hair. And of course, Nick Cave is one of my favorite musicians of all time. So very, very happy about that. And I thought, you know, that's a really great pairing for a movie that's taking place in Texas. That's almost like a kind of a modern day Western slash noir. So I was like pretty cool, pretty happy about that. Beautifully shot, beautiful landscapes. I really liked Chris Pine in this. Not that I've ever had a problem with Chris Pine. I pretty much like him in everything. And Ben Foster, I can kind of take or leave Ben Foster. I didn't recognize Ben Foster in this, because I guess I haven't seen him in a few years, but he, you know, he held his own, but I thought Chris Pine absolutely stole the show in this movie. I thought he just was dominating every time he was on screen, and was really, really good. I thought the bank robbery scenes were all really well done. And it was my thing. I do love movies about crime, as everyone knows. And, I do love movies. I love great cinematography. I did like the bank robberies. I just wish there was a little more of that going on than there was. Then we get to Jeff Bridges. And I did not like Jeff Bridges in this movie at all. Jeff Bridges was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal in this as a sheriff who's kind of figured out what's going on with these guys and wants to figure out who's doing these low level bank robberies. So he's kind of made it his, you know, retiring wish to, cause he's like on the way to retirement. So he's like, for whatever reason, he's decided that this is going to be his thing, is he's going to catch these guys. So he's out to get them. And I love Jeff Bridges as an actor, and a lot of the movies he's made over the years, I've loved. I really love young Jeff Bridges. Actually, this movie reminded me a lot of a young Jeff Bridges movie called Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, and which he is fucking fantastic in. I've loved Jeff Bridges through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. But I don't love Jeff Bridges in a movie called Crazy Heart. And I don't love Jeff Bridges in this movie. So the reason is that I just, first of all, he was just kind of mumbling his way through the movie, which I found quite distracting and kind of annoying. And the other thing is, I just didn't understand like why he was just so adamant and had such a hate on for these guys. Like, you know, later on, we kind of get a bit of a reason for this, like there's a reason for this hate on, but I just didn't understand, and I just wasn't supportive of the character very much. I was just, as the movie came to a conclusion, I was actually kind of annoyed. Like, I'm just kind of like, fuck off, like, what's your fucking problem? Like, I just didn't have any sympathy for the Jeff Bridges character at all. I had a little bit at one point, but most of the movie I did not. Most of the early part of the movie I didn't, and particularly at the end I did not at all. I was actually quite angry with him and annoyed. Gil Birmingham plays Jeff Bridges' partner Alberto. Thought he was fantastic as well. So overall, really liked the cast, really liked the premise. Really liked, at about two-thirds of the way through, I felt like the movie really picked up plot-wise and really sort of became a lot more engaging than the first two-thirds. Although the first two-thirds, I was still pretty into it. But it really, really picked up in the climax, and I really enjoyed it. So overall, I did enjoy this movie quite a bit, but Jeff Bridges really, really brought the movie down for me, which is, it's not normal for me to say that about him, because I usually like him quite a bit, but in this movie wasn't my thing at all. So that's kind of my review.
Okay.
This is part of, this is from the writer of both the Sicario movies and Wind River.
Yeah.
And Taylor Sheridan, who's also directed Wind River, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of a they say it's part of a trilogy. So I don't know if that includes Sicario and Wind River. I'm not sure. So the Southern Gothic trilogy or something.
No, Sicario wouldn't be in.
Yeah.
Included in that.
But I know you really love this. So yep. I was curious why you thought I'd love it so much and what you think of my impression of Jeff Bridges.
Well, I see where you're coming from with Jeff Bridges because he is kind of doing the same kind of shtick a little bit nowadays where he's just doing that like old man mumbly kind of thing. He's done it in a bunch of movies.
That's right. Like, I just feel like that's his thing now.
But I felt it was fine in this movie. Like, obviously he wasn't my favorite thing in this movie, so I understand. Yeah. Like, I really loved the interplay he had with his partner.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I was willing to go with that character, because I loved those two just, you know, sitting waiting outside of that bank.
Yeah, yeah.
For them, they're like, they're going to come rob this bank, I'm sure of it. And them just sitting outside that bank and just like the idle chit chat they had and all that. I really thought that was really great.
Yeah.
The two brothers I thought were great too. I actually thought I liked Ben Foster a little bit more.
Oh, really?
I did, but I mean, I liked Chris Pine too. Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong. I liked both of them, but for me, Ben Foster was clicked a little bit more with me personally. I know that when I talked about this movie, your main hesitation was that you thought it felt like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yes.
And I was like telling you, well, no, it's not. And I don't know where you got that from, but I was like, okay, well, whatever. And the reason I thought this would be kind of your jam is because we both like heist movies.
Yeah.
And this is also a Southern fried heist movie, like kind of leans towards Western a little bit, has those vistas and everything. And I'm like, I know he's going to appreciate stuff like this.
Yeah.
Like, if nothing else, he's going to appreciate just this kind of thing. So I was like, I get the impression that you love crime movies. Everyone knows you love crime movies. And I'm like, I think that this one's a crime movie that he's just not really giving that fair shake that I think it deserves. Because I was like, I didn't think you were going to love it.
Yeah.
But I was like, he's going to enjoy it.
And I totally did.
But I just think that you were hesitant for... I think your hesitations... I didn't quite get the Coen Brothers angle you were coming from.
I think it was the poster.
It could have been.
And I think it was Jeff Bridges. I think that was part of it, too. I was like, fuck, you know, it's just that Jeff Bridges in a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
It's just that Crazy Heart movie. I don't know what it was about that movie.
But I've never seen it.
It really bothered me.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? And it just felt like he was becoming typecast on purpose.
Right.
Or something. And I didn't feel like this was a heist movie. It was a bank robber movie.
Well, you know what I mean? Like a bank robbery movie.
Yeah, there was no planning, really. It was just, which I kind of liked. I mean, it was kind of like the, like, spontaneousness of it all. But yeah, and it just took such a turn as far as action went, which I really liked as well.
Yeah, I just thought it would be something that you'd probably dig a lot more than you were expecting to. So that's why I wanted to recommend it to you because...
Yeah, and I did.
I thought it'd be maybe not fully in your wheelhouse, but pretty close. Pretty close.
Yeah. So. And I think I can't believe I'm even saying this, but I think if it was like Tommy Lee Jones, I would have liked it a lot more.
That rather than Jeff Bridges?
Jeff Bridges. I've got marbles on my
You just have Tommy Lee Jones? I don't care.
Maybe 90s Tommy Lee Jones.
But... Fugitive Tommy Lee Jones? Yeah,
exactly.
They killed my wife. I don't care. All right. Well, my homework I watched last night because, you know, I'm a procrastinating motherfucker. No, I actually... was on vacation and it was difficult to fit in a 2-hour, 12-minute movie during vacation. So Josh has been harassing me for a while and so have a couple of listeners to watch Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yay!
From 2017. So that is the movie that I viewed. And man, what a full-on exploitation movie that is.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Right from the get-go, right when you first are introduced to Vince Vaughn's character, Bradley, and he's, like, just getting fired from his job at a tow truck company, you're like, this guy's gonna fucking explode. And he's gonna fucking explode soon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I know he's going to. Yeah. And sure enough, he explodes in the first, like, 15 minutes of this movie or so.
And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, he's going for it. He's going for it. And it involves a car. I'm not going to say anything else. So he's a guy. He gets fired from his job. His wife, played by Jennifer Carpenter, is pregnant and is expecting. And, you know, they're having a rough go of it because, you know, she's kind of been cheating on him and so on and so forth. And, you know, he's like, okay, well, I need to make some money because I lost my job. So I think I'm just going to go visit my buddy here who runs drugs.
Yeah.
I'm basically just going to deliver drugs for him. And, you know, she doesn't really want to do it, but he's like, I gotta support you and give for our baby. You know, you're doing 3 months, you know, we got to do something. So, you know, he ends up running the drugs. It's going pretty well for him. His relationship's kind of on the mend or whatever. And then his buddy says, okay, well, we're going to kind of team up with these Mexican gangster types.
Yeah.
And we're going to go do a pickup. And, you know, if this pickup works, we've got a whole new supply and, you know, business is going to boom. Obviously, things go wrong and it leads to a police shootout, which leads to our character Bradley getting a 7-year sentence in jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, at this moment, the movie's been going on for a while. It's a pretty slow burn.
Yeah.
Admittedly. But I'm completely engaged in this. Like, I'm still interested. Vaughn, who I'm used to seeing do stupid comedy, is just, like, there. He's just, like, present to the whole thing. He's just, like, steely. You're just, like, you're just waiting because you know he's going to fucking snap in this movie more than once. And you're just watching him and you're like, dude, he's going to snap. Mm-hmm. I'm like, he's already done it once. I know it's going to happen again. So he ends up in jail. And then Udo Kier shows up at the jail. And he's like, hey. He's like, do I know you? He's like, no, but you're going to know me because you know my bosses. And so you're going to listen to me. So he gives him the craziest fucking ultimatum I've ever heard in my life in the history of these kind of exploitation movies where he's like, hey, you owe us $3.2 million. We've got this Korean abortionist on salary. We've kidnapped your wife. We might let this abortionist guy go to town. What you need to do is you need to get yourself committed to this maximum security prison.
Yeah.
And kill this guy for us. And then we'll let her free. And I'm like, that's fucking crazy. And I'm like, and Udo Kier is just doing his usual, like, I'm Udo Kier. I'm fucking creepy kind of thing, right? So, sure enough, he beats the living shit out of some guards, gets himself sent to this maximum security prison called Red Leaf. And who's the warden at Red Leaf? Don fucking Johnson. Now, Don Johnson's had a resurgence for me with Django and this, among other things. And he's like the warden from hell in this movie.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't take no shit from nobody. I smoke cigarillos all day. My guards beat everybody up. I've got this secret fucking area of the prison that's behind a goddamn bookcase where I put everyone that's the really bad apples called Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
So, obviously, the guy who Vince Vaughn has to get is in Cell Block 99. So, again, he has to get himself sent there, so on and so forth. And then things just kind of, you know, escalate from there until the last half hour goes completely off the fucking rails and becomes the most insane exploitation kind of movie I've ever seen.
You've ever seen?
Well, pretty damn close. It's pretty fucking outrageous. I just find it hilarious that this prison has a subterranean area hidden behind a bookcase with torture devices on it because they hook him up to like this thing that shocks him all the time. And I'm just like, and they have broken glass on his cell floor. And I'm like, what the fuck? This movie's going crazy right now. And then, you know, we get super violent. We get super bloody. We get super beat the shit out of everybody and do many, many fucking head stomps on the way to a finish. And in that last half hour, I'm sitting there in my seat going, fuck yeah, bring it, bring it, fucking bring it, do it, fucking bring it. And then while I'm saying that, I'm like, fucking practical effects, bring it, bring it, fucking bring it. So if you haven't figured it out yet,
I pretty much love this movie for the most part.
I think
it's pretty fucking outrageous. And I think S. Craig Zahler, who wrote and directed this, has his fucking finger on the pulse of genre exploitation filmmaking. Like, and have a guy like Vince Vaughn starring in a fucking movie like this, I'm like, whoa. Because I know this guy from Dodgeball.
Yeah.
This movie should be, if you can dodge my foot, your head's staying in one fucking piece. That's what this movie should be.
No kidding.
There's so many fucking head stomps in this movie, dude.
Like, yeah, it's violent.
It's fucking, that last half hour, I'm just like, what can they do next?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, they didn't just do that. Oh, yeah, he fucking did that.
See, and that's the difference between John Wick, right? Like, yeah. Like, that's what I mean. Like, with the John Wick's really violent, but it's not like this violent.
No, this is like no, they're not gonna. Yeah, they are.
Exactly.
So,
weren't you just like, oh, like I there was just so many times where I'm just like, I can't believe that that's Vince Vaughn, like,
yeah.
doing that. Like, I can't believe he actually agreed to. And this is happening. Like, this is a big star, right?
Well, and the thing I also liked about the fight choreography in this movie is that it felt real because it was a little sluggish, and it felt like something that if you really saw a fight between two people who weren't, you know, fight choreographed or whatever, that's how it would look.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't have the sped up cameras. It didn't have anything like that. It was kind of like a modern day Seagal movie speed. But actually convincing.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like, you know, it didn't seem like these guys were like super fucking like insane great fighters. Like in all these movies, they always feel like they're the best fighters in the world, right?
Yeah.
And Vince Vaughn says early in the movie, his character says, oh, I did a little bit of boxing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that comes into play. But the fight scenes felt like they were how things would really go down.
Yeah.
Until it gets super fucking hyper violent. Then maybe not so much. But, you know, the early fights with the guards and the fights in the yards and all that. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's how it goes down. And also, you're a prison movie.
Yeah.
And I fucking love prison movies. So I'm like, okay. But, dude, some of the stuff they do in the finale of this movie.
I know.
Fuck. I'm just shaking my head. I'm like, yeah, yeah.
I kind of remember. I remember there was a dragging scene.
That is the fucking most insane moment in the entire movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to do an action because I don't want to spoil it for people. To...
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. My God. So rad, but so wrong.
Yeah.
The only other thing I really have to say about this is I was hesitating on this for a long time. And, you know, it's what I do when I see a movie that's 2 hours, 12 minutes long. And I'm like, oh, what if I don't like it? If I don't like it, I'm going to be so disappointed. I have that weird OCD that way.
Yeah.
Now I can safely say I can watch Bone Tomahawk and Dragged Across Concrete without really having any issues.
I don't know, but I've heard mixed on
but dragged. I mean, like, now I
but
know
Bone
what,
Tomahawk, you can
but
for
now
sure.
I know what his style is.
And Kurt's in that.
Well, exactly. But now I know what his style is, because I've heard his style is slow burn,
yeah,
then explode for the last third of the movie, yeah, or whatever. And I've heard Bone Tomahawk is the same way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now that I know that's what to expect, I'm fully on board with that, yeah, kind of thing, right? And, you know, this is a grimy movie, not the prettiest movie to look at. But I don't want my prison movies to be pretty to look at. I want them to be like, holy fuck, that toilet's filled with shit, and they're making him sit in that cell for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
He's got to wrap his shirt around his head because it's disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I want from prison movies, you know? And I didn't enjoy Zahler's Puppet Master movie that he wrote, to be honest. Mm. So that's why I also was kind of a little bit hesitant, because I was like, well, I didn't like the Puppet Master one that much. So, but it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Like, honestly. I do kind of get the Tarantino comparisons he's getting in a way, because it does have that off the cuff kind of dialogue where there's moments that come up that you're not really expecting it.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, it's kind of funny, but I wouldn't have expected something like that to be said, you know? And there's like, you know, just that whole fucking Korean abortionist angle alone. I'm just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Just crazy. And then, I think he also got compared because his movies do build like Tarantino's movies tend to. And there was a lot of like R&B on the soundtrack, like 70s sounding R&B on the soundtrack, like the OJs and stuff like that. And I didn't know until I was watching the end credit that he actually co-wrote every single song in this movie.
Oh, I didn't know
Craig
that.
Craig Zahler co-wrote every song in this movie.
Oh, cool.
And I thought that was really cool, too, because they sound like they would be 70s Motown songs for the most part.
Huh.
And I'm just like, he co-wrote all these songs, and he got the OJs to do three of them?
Really?
Like, that's pretty rad.
He co-wrote songs that the OJs did?
The OJs did three of his songs for the movie.
Oh, I totally
Yeah, so know. I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I dug it.
Nice.
I dug it a lot. So, I mean, I know I'm not alone in this, and now I've actually joined the Brawl and Cellblock 99 fan club. I'm looking forward to seeing his other stuff, so yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I actually want to watch it again now.
Yeah, you should. Josh's VHS Adventures!
Yeah.
You always sound so enthusiastic.
Oh, you know, man.
Maybe we need to discontinue your VHS.
No, no, we have to do this because it's getting me through. So I'll just backstory on this one. Like, I meant to watch actually a couple of VHS, and I was gonna like pick the best one,
yep.
And then I ended up not doing that. So, so I just picked the one.
So is the other option for another episode then?
Yeah, but I the ones that really work well are the ones like Whitefire, like those like
American Tiger.
Yeah, like those 80s, yeah. Like kind of, you know, Italian directed ones, yeah. Like those action movies or horror movies. That are
like the first time you made me watch Lady Terminator on VHS.
Yeah. And actually I was Lady Terminator? Oh yeah, Terminator.
Yeah.
And like there was, and I remember I made you watch Raw Force on
Raw
VHS.
Force on VHS the first time.
And so shit like that. And even when I was watching Creepazoids and realizing David Dakota did like Lady Avenger, I'm like, I have that on VHS. Like that's a good one too. So it's those ones I need to like, I kind of, you know, and I think what I've been doing, and I've talked about this before, is I just think I keep going to the ones that I'm like, oh, I just want to get rid of this one because I have too much shit. But I really think I need to watch more of those, and I intended to do that. But
we have another Bigfoot and Squirrels.
Oh, fuck. I thought that thing was going to sell for
so. That squirrel's so sad about his buddy.
It only sold for $10.50 on eBay. I was kind of bummed out. I thought I was going to make a mint on that one.
At least it sold. So what do we got this time?
This time we have a movie called Gunshy from 1998, directed by Jeff Celentano. Okay.
And starring nobody we know.
Starring William Peterson.
Oh.
From Manhunter and
CSI.
To Live and Die in LA and CSI. And, okay, fuck, I'm really having, there's a lot of pricks in, there's a lot of pricks on this episode. So again, we've got a character who's like a total dickhead, and that William Peterson's playing. He's this guy named Jake, and, I think I just put a body double thing together. Anyway, Jake is a writer, goes home, finds his wife's banging some dude, so he's like, well, fuck, I'm out of here. And off he goes to like Atlantic City, kind of like leaving Las Vegas style almost seems like he's going to go like drink himself to death. So he just goes there, starts drinking. He's in a bar and then, he runs across Meatloaf, and Meatloaf's like this kind of like other drunk dude, but kind of seems like a bit of a bad criminal guy.
What year is this?
This is 1998.
Same year as Black Dog.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the loaf is like hitting on this girl and, you know, clearly like no one wants to fuck with him because he's obviously a bit unhinged and tough. And Peterson basically says, you know, starts calling him names. And he's like this newspaper reporter, right? So he can't fight or anything. So he starts to get his ass kicked by Meatloaf. And then they takes him out into the street and starts beating the shit out of him out there. And then to the rescue comes Michael Wincott playing a guy named Frankie. Michael Wincott, if you don't know who he is... And I often get it. I often think of your buddy from the Police Academy movies, Michael...
Winslow.
So
fuck
like,
that guy.
Totally fuck that guy. So there's often times where I'll see Michael Wincott and I won't watch the movie because am thinking of...
Is he the brother of Jeff Wincott?
He's the brother of Jeff Wincott. He was Top Dollar, the villain in The Crow.
Okay.
And he was also... he played Paul Rothschild in The Doors. But he's been in tons of, like, low-budget movies.
I think I like Jeff better.
He usually plays a villain. I really like this guy.
Okay.
And I always have. Anyway, he comes to the rescue, and he's this guy, Frankie. He's like a low-level criminal who works for, like, he's kind of like a henchman for this Irish crime boss. So he, like, takes Meatloaf off of William Peterson, and William Peterson is being a total dick to Wincott as well. But eventually they kind of establish a bit of a friendship where Wincott's like, look, I want to learn stuff about the world. Like, I want to learn, like, about books, and I want to learn about writing. And in exchange, I'll, like, let you learn a bit about my life, like this, you know, shaking down people and stuff like that. So they form this kind of unlikely friendship, but not really a friendship, because it's really Michael Wincott, I think, that wants a friend, because he doesn't have a lot, and Peterson just treats him like shit. He's just an asshole to him, including trying to fuck his girlfriend, played by Diane Lane. So, you know, through all of this, I'm just like, okay, what I'm getting out of this is that William Peterson's character is a total asshole, and I don't care about him at all. And then it goes, when it starts to get into him wanting to fuck Diane Lane, I'm just like, okay, I have no sympathy for this guy at all. But it is also making me go, but Michael Wincott can actually act. He's not just this, like, thug that we usually see in movies, or, like, serial killer. He's actually pretty good. And he, throughout this whole movie, he's pretty good. So I enjoyed seeing that. I thought Diane Lane was okay. I thought Kevin Gage shows up. He plays a cop in this. He's been in a lot of low budget stuff like Laid to Rest and Strangeland. But overall, and Musetta Vander shows up as well. That was another big selling point for me. Do you know who she is? She was Lash in Oblivion. Have you ever seen Oblivion? Oh,
okay, yeah. The Full Moon.
Which I really like the two Oblivion movies.
Yeah, I don't mind them. They're pretty good.
And anyway, there's this one kind of gothy chick that has a whip, played by Musetta Vander. It's kind of like her. She's been in lots of stuff. That's kind of what I think of with her. Anyway, it turns out she's also the director's wife. But she had a very small role in this. But yeah, it's just one of these movies that I kind of wished I'd watched something else, but I'm kind of glad it's over. But I think if you're a fan of like low budget, like noir-y type movies, which were pretty big in the 90s, there was a lot of these, like,
yeah,
these
late kind of 90s for
Tarantino
sure.
ripoff. But this isn't like Pulp Fiction. This is more of a drama. Then you'd probably like this. I mean, if you're a Peterson fan, you might like this, although he's a total asshole in this. But I can see some people enjoying this movie. Certainly not something I would go back to, but I did like seeing Michael Wincott getting a little more to do than what he's normally given. So, yeah. Gunshy won't be returning to this anytime soon. It will be going on eBay imminently. But I am looking forward to, yeah, going through some boxes and maybe trying to find some stuff that is a little more fun. Because that is kind of why I wanted to do this. And this wasn't one of those cases. Anyway, we'll leave that on a down note.
All right. Josh's VHS Adventures! All right. We're done.
Yes.
We're going to go and start writing songs for our new band, Halifax Fuck Party. And in the meantime, while we're writing some jamming punk tunes about syphilis, how about you go and, join our Facebook discussion group? Because, you know, we always like to hear from listeners, and we also like to have discussions with listeners about movies, even the dumbest movies in the world, because usually I'm the one who brings them up. And, tell me if I should watch that 2009 Children of the Corn, but don't be surprised if you get banned. No, I am just kidding. Otherwise, Twitter, Instagram, and all that stuff, search for GBW Podcast.
Hey, I got to say something about Twitter.
Yep.
Because I posted about, I know I talked on our last episode about Sid and Nancy, and I think it was our last episode about the Pogue song Haunted.
Yep.
And how much I loved it. And then I posted on our Facebook group about it, and Kate O'Riordan's the singer. She was a member of the Pogues at the time. Anyway, Cato Riordan just followed us on Twitter, and I was so fucking excited.
Nice. That's good. Good, good, good. So, yeah. Where was I?
You were like the usual, like...
Yeah, the usual spiel. So, rating and review on iTunes. We recently got a really great review on there. Unfortunately didn't write their name down. I'll do that next episode. I'll bring it up. But we appreciate any review we get, especially when... they're just like, I like to hear from people who have discovered things because of us or are engaged by spending the 3 hours with us every 2 weeks. And it really means a lot to us. So I just wanted to say it does mean a lot. So just keep them going and spread the word about the podcast and tell some friends and join the discussions. And, you know, let's all be movie nerds together is basically what I'm trying to say here. And let's go write some punk songs, Josh.
Yeah, but we won't be assholes and then go and fucking do drugs and like call our girlfriends a bitch. And
no, we'll be too busy going
shoot up people.
We're just gonna be too busy dipping our wick in as many candles as we can, you know what I'm saying? On that note,
all right, Nick.
Good, Nick the dick. Good night, everybody.
Bye.